A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a spacecraft full of whatevers here in 2020. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Cove.
And joining us today from the Blank Check Podcast, returning guest, he was in The Tick. I saw a great episode of Search Party with him. It's Griffin Newman.
Hello. Thank you guys for having me back. I have to ask right off the bat, because I like to keep track of how many times I've been on a podcast. If I'm on a podcast once, it's because I'm looking to eventually join the Five Timers Club. Now, the last time I recorded with you guys, it was very long, and so it was released as two episodes. So I'm asking here, Kill Bill rule, do we count this as two separate episodes? Is this my third appearance or my second appearance? Because it was recorded with the intention of it being one episode.
We had this discussion.
I'm going to let Kenny make the rule on this.
Okay, you did have this discussion internally.
I'm a rules guy. Not about you. About Emily Vandewerf, because Emily Vandewerf is our most frequent guest.
Another one of the great talkers. Yes.
The best.
Yes.
And she was on a Matrix episode that turned into a two-parter that I think the second part of it.
Really? Emily had a lot to say about the Matrix?
I know. Who thought?
I don't think I've ever seen her write about that movie.
No. So I believe we decided it counts as one.
Okay,
I think it should count as one, don't you, Phil?
Look, I'm fine with whatever ruling you guys make.
My feeling on this is whatever it takes to get Griffin to come back on this podcast as much as humanly possible.
The answer is one, then. As much as humanly possible means it's one.
Sure.
Thank you for joining us for the second time.
And we have a third episode planned that we will be recording shortly. We can tease that at the end of this episode, right?
Yeah.
We will tease it. Yes.
Great.
Yes.
Okay. It'll be great. So, yes. Excited to be on for the second time.
Yeah.
Looking forward to my
So great
third
to have you back. Yep.
Yeah. So, Griffin, you were on Screen Drafts, where you did a very short episode about the Muppets.
Yes.
It was really just sort of about the it was what, almost 4 hours
long?
It was
about 4 hours, yeah. Released as a one-parter, but yeah.
Released as a one-parter.
It's syndication. I'm hoping to break it up into four so I can get more residuals.
Yeah.
But we wanted to bring you on for the shitty Muppet movie. We wanted to bring you on for the one that for the nadir of the of the Muppets franchise.
Because on Screen Draft, I was drafting all of the Muppets movies, and this barely even was referenced. This was not even part of consideration.
You talked more about Elmo in Grouch
Absolutely, a better film.
Than you did about this.
And look, it's not that I'm not here to just fully dogpile on this movie, because I love the Muppets enough that there are things I find interesting about this film. But I do think it is, it is amongst the bottom rung of things ever made involving the Muppets. It's not only far and away, I think, the worst of the theatrical films, but I think there are a great many TV specials and such that are better than this.
No question.
Before,
I've never seen this movie, but before seeing this movie, I had a Muppets rule, which was if the Muppets are in it, I'm going to enjoy it.
Yeah. Yes. And, yes.
And this movie broke me. This is a very, very bad movie.
I think this is a very bad film. And I will say my relationship to this movie has been odd because it came out, I'm 10 in 1999. So I was right at that threshold of like, I had been such a big Muppets kid. They were like my whole thing. I was the oldest, the first kid my parents had. And my mother was very overprotective about media stuff, which I think really came back to bite her in the ass later.
it's the old snack drawer rule.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But so for whatever weird reason, she wouldn't let me watch almost anything modern. She thought everything modern was either too violent if it was an action-based thing, any sort of superhero thing, or it was too cynical, sarcastic, if it was like a comedy-based thing. So all of the Nicktoons were out of the question, and the X-Men, and the Power Rangers, and the Ninja Turtles, and all these things that you know, only true 90s kids would understand. I was sort of like on the outside looking in. And the two things I was allowed to watch carte blanche were Looney Tunes and the Muppets, which is funny because both of those are both very cynical and very violent. There's a lot of cynical violence.
Looney Tunes, I think, more than...
Looney Tunes is like shooting Elmer Fudd in the face and then saying, like, ain't I a stinker? Like, it's like... Yeah. I don't understand why, but it was this thing, I think, of like, if the thing had existed earlier than 1980, my mom viewed it as a classic, and then it was fine.
Okay.
You know? And I watched a lot of older Hanna-Barbera on that same line as well.
But we snuck Tom and Jerry past my wife, who's much like your mom.
Yes.
But, you know, I have all these children. And it stood the test of time. How bad can it be?
Right.
Yeah, and you have, you know, Jerry basically is constantly just kicking Tom the balls. That's what the cartoon is.
I mean, it's itchy and scratchy. Yeah. It's just slightly less violent.
Barely less.
Yeah. You know? But so I was watching all of that stuff, which I think very much developed my entire personality and certainly my sense of humor. I think, like, you know, 75% comes from Looney Tunes and Muppets combined, because that was just my entire input. So when this comes out and I'm 10, I'm at that stage where I am like, am I too old to be excited for a Muppet movie? Like, do I not?
Right.
I'm in my mind going, do I not like the Muppets anymore? Mm-hmm. And about a year or two later, I double down and I go like, fuck it, I'm going to be an adult Muppet fan. Like, I very clearly remember being 12 and going like, I'm throwing down the gauntlet now. I'm going to be one of those weird adults who cares too much about the Muppets. But so this came at that point where I was like questioning it all. I remember there being a trailer that I saw before. I'm trying to think what movie it must have been. But I remember going to see some movie with my dad opening weekend that felt like me seeing a slightly grown-up movie earlier that summer, probably some May 99 release. I mean, you guys have either covered it or are going to cover it. I could look at the schedule and try to figure out what it was.
It's definitely, it's a Sony movie, whatever it is.
It's Forces of Nature.
Sony... It's not maybe Forces of Nature.
No, the other thing, I remember it being the Union Square Theater. What is now the Regal Union Square 14 at the time was the United Artists. I remember seeing the trailer, and I remember it being like an 8 or 9 p.m. screening on like a Friday night or Saturday night. It felt special. My dad was taking me to see a movie in the evening. My little brother wasn't coming, and I was seeing more adult trailers and getting an adult reaction to everything. And the first teaser for Muppets from Space played, And the first teaser kind of felt like they were trying to sell it more to adults. And it got a really big response from the audience. And I looked it up to try to see what the trailer was. It's one of those fake out trailers where they try to make it seem like it's a very serious movie. So it's like high CGI footage of the planets and space and a very serious narrator saying, like, we don't know where they come from. We don't know what how long they've been here. You know, whatever it is. But like, right. and then it goes like, but the one thing we do know, and it hard cuts to that moment that's like Annie McDowell and Miss Piggy punching each other.
Yeah, correct.
And then there
I have
was
a question about that fight when we get to it.
Sure. Then there were
I got a question about all of Miss Piggy's fights, quite frankly.
Look, there are many questions about everything Miss Piggy does in this movie. But it went from that moment to maybe a couple random like chaotic images. And then saying Muppets from Space, the trailer, very short. But the thing I remember is at the very end of the teaser, they put the shot of when everyone's on the beach and there's the woman with the bare midriff.
Yes.
And Sam the Eagle is looking at her and his jaw drops. So the teaser was pretty much just these shots of adults surrounded by Muppets on a beach.
Yep.
It looking like some sort of rave. And there's like a fist fight. And then a Muppet leering at a scantily clad woman. And I was like, are they trying to make, like, the Muppet South Park movie? Like, are they trying to, like, square this circle because they know Muppets have fallen off with kids and trying to make the Muppet movie that's a little more hard-edged? So I was kind of into it at the time because I was like, oh, I'm going to love seeing this because this will – I cannot feel like a dork for wanting to go see a Muppet movie.
Right. Well, there's something I want to piggyback on that because it does feel there were some things that jumped out at me very early on as I was watching this. And I was thinking less South Park, more Austin Powers.
You nailed it. That is what I think it actually they were trying
like,
to sell
it as.
Yes.
It feels a little bit like that sort of genre that they're trying to hit. I want to pause this to you, Griffin, because I don't know the Muppets as well as you do. But they play in a lot of genres. That's kind of the point, right? There's a lot of like metatextuality of like deconstructing different genres and being very winky. Mm-hmm. But I don't think sci-fi really works for them.
No, I don't.
Like it's a genre that doesn't
work. I mean, oh boy, there's a lot I could get into here. I mean, so in order to dig into this, I need to throw out my grand unifying theory of the Muppet franchise.
Please.
Which I've talked about most times I've talked about the Muppets on podcasts, which is, I'd say, 75% of my appearances on other podcasts. and this, to some people, sounds like some Pixar theory bullshit, which I say this. I think the Pixar theory is bullshit. I think that kind of stuff where it's like, we're going to come up with an explanation for why all the Pixar movies are in the same universe. They're not. They were not intended that way. That's taking like sort of in-jokey Easter eggs and treating them as very literal text in a way that goes against the actual movies. And you're distorting the actual stories of these movies so hard to make them fit into your like, you know, your red string cork board. But by all accounts, even though the Muppets play with a very loose mythology, this seems to be what Jim Henson intended. Okay. So the Muppets start out, you know, local television, commercials, late night TV appearances. He has 15, 20 years when he's developing these characters in different mediums, different appearances before
and
they
this
go
is in the
to
60s.
50s and 60s, right.
50s and 60s, but, okay.
Before you get to The Muppet Show, which is where everything really crystallizes. By that point, a lot of those characters are well known, but this is when he's really putting a frame around them. Because up until that point, it was like, the Muppets, you know, it's Rolf is going on the Ed Sullivan Show, or, you know, it's Kermit selling coffee or whatever it is. People are going to yell at me because both of those examples are wrong. But that was the kind of stuff he was doing, right? Yeah. And then the Muppet Show was the frame around it of, well, now we're building out a cast of characters. They exist with us in this world. They have their own theaters. They are entertainers. You know, they have their own sort of interior lives. It's not a puppet show. It's a show about puppets putting on a show, if that makes any sense.
Right.
So it becomes so much about, for me, I think the Muppets at that point were Jim Henson taking everything he felt about entertainers and about show business and about artists and about all that sort of shit. And from the people he had worked with and all the different stereotypes of different types of people in the entertainment industry. And then the Muppets, when it came to the Muppet Show, were really brought to life by him hiring a lot of kind of very sort of Borscht Belt-y comedy writers.
right,
who helped develop the sensibility of the thing. Real kind of vaudeville-y guys, like Jerry Jewell and everyone. So when the Muppet movies start happening, A, it's the big shift to, we're going to have the Muppets existing in the real world. They've always existed on, like, a soundstage, you know? The Muppet Show is, they're in this theater. And when they're making other TV appearances, they're in a void or they're on a talk show on a set in front of an audience. And this is right. Like, the Muppets are going to be out on our streets. They're going to be in nature. They're going to be in, like, human restaurants, bikes. Like, all this sort of shit. Right. Yeah. And the first Muppet movie has this frame, the Muppet movie, which is, it starts with everyone going to a back lot to see a screening of the Muppet movie. Mm-hmm. The Muppets are watching the movie that you have ostensibly just paid to see. Mm-hmm. And before,
there's like three layers to it, yes. Right? There's like,
it's crazy. But so yes, the opening of the film is everyone pulling up to the lot, going into the private screening room, and Kermit's nephew, Robin. Well, this is important. I promise, for Muppets from Space. He says, so is this how it really happened? Is this how all the Muppets got together? And Kermit says, kind of. So you understand the movie you're about to watch is ostensibly the movie the Muppets made to mythologize themselves. But it's not 100% accurate. It is.
They are unreliable narrators of their own history.
Right.
It's, yeah. Their, and then, it's their 8 Mile. It's their absolutely. Get Rich or Die Trying.
It's their King of Staten Island.
It's their King of Staten Island, for instance. Yeah.
So you're watching the film. The projector breaks down a couple times. You have further interjections from the screening room. And the movie ends with them making it to Hollywood, meeting Lou Lord, played by Orson Welles, in the greatest one-line performance in the history of cinema, who prepares the standard rich and famous contract for Kermit
what a line, too.
And Friends. Yes. And so he gives them this multi-picture deal. And the end of the movie is this musical number where you see the Muppets making the movie that you have just watched. They're now on a back lot recreating the events you just saw, which it was established was a fictional film because the Muppets themselves are watching this, but now we're watching them make the movie in the fictional movie that they're watching. And then the projector blows up and they're back at the screen. The common belief from people who take the Muppets too seriously is that every other Muppet movie from that point on is one of the movies that they made under that contract. And I think they're obviously, it's not a group of characters that deals in sort of continuity, right? But I think it helps actually how you view the movies and how you rate their success, because you go, that's the transition point. The Muppet movie is the transition point from the Muppets existing on TV, in the Muppet Show, on the late night appearances, to movies. And it's saying they are now a stock company of actors. They're going to make different entertainments for you. And they might play different characters. They might change what their backstory is. These are all just films that the Muppets are making for you, as if the Muppets are the Marx Brothers, where sometimes they have their own names and sometimes they don't, you know? And sometimes they're brothers and sometimes they're not. Like, so Great Muppet Caper starts with a song that's, hey, a movie. They're announcing that it's a movie. And then they say, we're the Muppets. I'm now a reporter. He's a photographer. He's a reporter. Kermit and Fozzie are brothers. Like, they just change all the rules. Kermit meets Piggy.
This also explains why this movie feels like a contractual obligation.
Thank you. And that's why we need to talk about. I need to talk about all of these things. Right. So those are the three that Jim Henson is alive to see. Is a Muppet movie, Great Muppet Caper, right. Muppets Take Manhattan. Right. All three of which create different narratives for how the Muppets met and got together. They recast them in different ways, even though they're all playing themselves, ostensibly. Mm-hmm. But in different genres. Then Jim Henson dies, and the company starts floundering a little bit, more than a little bit. And Brian Henson takes over. And Brian Henson, good puppeteer, good performer in his own right, but very much seems like someone who stepped up to the plate of someone needed to take over this. And I think he perhaps might have had a very different career if his father had lived longer. But he directs the next two movies, Treasure Island and Christmas Carol.
I'm sure you know more about the Henson family too, right? He's one of five, right, Brian?
Yes, yes. And almost all of them went into the family business.
And I believe now it's run by one of his daughters because they've kind of kicked Brian out.
Yes, so now I think it's more directly run by Lisa Henson, I believe
it
is.
Yeah, that's right.
Who, for a period of time, was, I believe, the head of production at Columbia Pictures, which resulted in this movie and Elmo and Grouchland. I'll get back to that in a second. But so Brian is pushed into the driver's seat at this point in time. Brian later goes on to like help create things like Farscape. And it feels like that's maybe more of what he would have done if left to his own devices. But he's in the position of you need to keep these characters alive. So they do the two storybook adaptations. They do the movies where the Muppets are literally playing other characters in pre-existing text, and they're more heightened and stylized. And people criticize them and go, that's not what I want to see. I want to see the Muppets being the Muppets. And I go, I think this is the Muppets being the Muppets because this is like the Muppets summer stock. This is like the Muppets doing their production. It all works for me. And I think both of those films are good. But they Treasure Island has a big drop off from Christmas Carol. Christmas Carol does well, but not incredibly well. And it was also just Disney's bar for success is so high. That deal falls apart. Lisa Henson's at Sony. They move over to Sony and she gets these two films greenlit. I think it was very much, we've got to make two movies at the same time. Among Grouchland and Muppets from Space were filming, I believe, simultaneously on like
both in North Carolina. Yeah.
There was some weird deal that she clearly helped orchestrate to be like, I want to give a lot of business to the Henson Company, which at that point was still in charge of the Muppets and of the Sesame Street characters. They've now sold off both of those things. Disney owns Muppets outright. The Sesame Street characters are owned by Children's Television Workshop outright, which has now just renamed itself Sesame Workshop. So Henson Company is just sort of the tech side of things, their creature building, and then like Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, Fraggle Rock, all the other sort of appendix stuff. But so this movie comes at a point in time where they had done the Disney storybook thing, then that sort of hit an end of the road. They felt like they had to do something new with the characters. They had done the TV show Muppets Tonight, which I liked, which was them trying to do a modern Muppet show, I think was pretty good. And the other thing that I think worked with Muppets Tonight was for the first time they said, there's a turnaround happening. The old guard is starting to retire or die. We need to get these new younger puppeteers to create their own characters who they have some ownership over. So it's not just people doing impressions of other characters. So there's a mix. Muppets Tonight had all the classics in it, but they're taking certain characters who had existed in smaller capacities. Rizzo and Clifford are now getting upped to like the main leagues. And then introducing some entirely new characters like Pepe the King Prong and Bobo the Bear. And I think Muppets from Space was A, trying to be like, we need a movie to really sell these new characters. Because we're banking on the next generation of Muppets to coexist on the Mount Rushmore along with the classics. We need there to be some refreshment. Yeah. And I think they also were like, the storybook thing is feeling kiddish. We need to make something that's wildly different. So this there's the incredibly stupid decision we'll dig into to make the whole film not a musical, but a lip sync musical to fucking like
Brutal. 70s
funk classics disc three. like just like what I think of is just classic 1990s birthday party music.
Bar
like
music.
Right. But like funk music that had become so homogenized and gentrified and uncool that it was what I would hear at Chuck E. Cheese when I was eight, you know?
Yeah.
Like songs that now with some distance you listen to it, you're like, right, of course, these are good songs. But it, but at that point in the late 90s, these songs were so fucking overplayed.
100%. Right. I want to just jump in real quick and unpack just a little bit more of the Henson Company's financial issues at the time. In December of 97, the Jim Henson Company landed a huge development deal with Sony, which might very well have been teed up by Lisa as far as
true.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Where the Henson Company would develop up to 15 movies over 5 years, and the slate would cost pictures north of $200 million, basically, financed, distributed by Sony. Mm-hmm. Only three movies materialized out of that deal.
Was it these two and Buddy? Was Buddy the third one? Okay.
Buddy, Muppets from Space, and Elmo and Gretel.
Because that was a big part of it. Like things like Buddy, where they could be like, this isn't a Muppet movie. It isn't a Sesame Street movie. This is a live action movie that Henson is producing from a story perspective. It fits into their wheelhouse. And also there's some element of creature stuff. Like that movie is very realistic animals.
Right. They also, so then they had this Muppets Tonight, which was in 96.
That's the last Disney ABC, thing for a while until
ABC
Disney
canceled
it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. So then after the failure of most of their projects, the Jim Henson Company agrees to be sold off to a German media company called EM.
Yeah, these are the dark ages.
$680 million. For $680 million. EM then had major fiscal problems and the Henson family bought back the company for $89 million.
Yes.
That's how bad that company was in finals.
It's a great short sale.
It's a great short sale. But this, I think, speaks to everything that we're talking about, which is like they are not making decisions from the best creative place. They're making it more from a financial place. This, and that's never where
am I correct in thinking this is the last thing before they sell to the German company? Right. It's right after this. This is when they throw their hands up and they're like, I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
Before we go on, I want to ask you a question, Griffin, that you may table, but do you have a theory? Because I want to keep going with this. So I don't want to take you too far off track, but why did the Muppets kind of fall off from from the late 80s?
Yeah.
To, frankly, they've never come back. That's very clear to me. But
at
least
the same
to the
level,
Jason
no.
Siegel.
Right.
No,
right.
But, you know, so many properties have.
Yeah.
At the same level or higher. Obviously, I think the Transformers are higher than they've ever been.
Yeah.
Maybe not right now, but, you know, the reboot. Why they never came back, why they basically took a 20-year hiatus from not relevance, because he never went away. They just stopped being...
And they were still... Yes. I mean, here's my answer for you. I do have a concise answer. I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the Muppets are, both as characters and as like a larger property, both from audiences, from the people who greenlight these projects, and from very often the people who are developing these projects directly. And some of these things I like a lot and some of them I like less, but I'm pretty accepting of most things in the Muppet canon. I try to find something to like to some degree. I think there's like, you have characters like the Looney Tunes and the Mickey Mouse characters, for example, right? Who have gone so far afield from what they originally were. There was a gradual process of them sort of being watered down more and more and more until they just became corporate mascots that they could stretch to use however they wanted. And sometimes you get a nice good thing that comes out of it. I think the current Looney Tunes that are on HBO Max are probably the best Looney Tunes things that have been done since Chuck Jones.
Oh, wow, really?
They're really good. I'm a big fan.
I'll check it out.
I think they finally got it right. And the current Mickey Mouse shorts that are now on the Disney Channel, I think, are really good. Now, I think
they're
these two things have something
brilliant.
In common.
Brilliant. I think they're the best.
Kenny is all about Mickey's new shit.
They're unbelievable. And Phil, I don't know if you've watched them yet, but they're unbelievable. And I'm hoping – I haven't watched the Looney Tunes yet because it just hasn't happened. But I can't wait to watch those. I hope.
If you like the Mickey Mouse shorts, I think it's a very similar approach back to basics in the right kind of way. But this, yes. Okay, so this folds into all of that. Mm-hmm. They can eventually circle back to them. They can reuse them in these different ways. But that only comes after a point where you've stretched these characters into so many different directions that they can kind of mean anything, right?
Yes.
But the Muppets are closer to something like Monty Python. They are, for all intents and purposes, a troupe. And I don't just mean that the characters are a troupe, which they do function as, but also the people making them. I think so often, because you're not seeing the human face, as people talk about, oh, who's doing the voice for the Muppets? And they're not understanding that it's like, you had like 10 puppeteers who were playing all these characters together for decades. They were developing these characters side by side. The relationships between the characters corresponded with the relationships between them. They were also helping building the puppets. They were doing the voices and they were doing the physicality. They were helping write at the projects. And then when they brought outside writers on, like Jerry Jewell, they were very much part of the family. They weren't just, you're hired to write a spec script. Yeah. They were, you know, you're the Muppets in-house writer. There was very much that sort of troop mentality. And so I think the second the troupe starts falling apart, which it happens because Jim Henson dies, then Richard Hunt dies very shortly after, and then everyone starts to spread apart a little bit. Frank Oz goes more off into directing. They never understood that in order to keep the Muppets healthy, you had to build a new troupe. They needed to view it more like what happened after 1980 on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah,
you know, they needed to go like, let's look at the lessons of what didn't work and field test and trial and error until we find a new good ensemble. And I think part of that is finding the right people to take over the legacy characters. And part of that is letting people develop new characters, that there can be some new juice and excitement and personal stake. You can let those develop. And they've never really gotten to the place of doing that. Muppets Tonight was the closest they came to incubating that stuff again. And I think some good stuff came out of it. This movie is them trying to put a bunch of that stuff on the big screen, and it doesn't work because they involved a lot of outside people. And even the Siegel movies, which I like, and the second one he had no participation in, by the way. But the two modern Disney films, let's say, they were both outside writers, Nicholas Stoller and Siegel, writing the film and then just giving the script to the puppeteers and saying, here's the script, you know? And even just Walter, which people complain about, Walter, the new character, is like, well, because that's a puppeteer didn't develop it. And that's the bones of the Muppets. It's hard to just treat the Muppets like it's Spider-Man and go, here's a new writer. He's going to do a 12-issue arc. Because so much
but
of
would
it
you
is
also say that,
the
like,
performance,
the,
all
the,
of it.
There's a specificity to the tone. Yes. That is so narrow a target too. Yeah. Like I watched the Siegel Amy Adams movie the other day, which I actually quite liked for what it is. Mm-hmm. It just feels tonally, you know, it's more Flight of the Conchords.
Absolutely.
Than it is Muppets, and that's there's nothing wrong with that. I love Flight of the Conchords.
Yeah,
but the specificity of tone that the Muppets have, they couldn't even do with Muppets from Space, let alone when you bring in an entirely new group.
Well, yes. And I think a big part of it is that the Muppets were, as characters and in the tone, this bridge between old classical razzle-dazzle Hollywood and countercultural new Hollywood. You know, they were very much like 70s countercultural figures, but they were so entrenched comedically in like Milton Berle routines, you know, there's this weird sort of like space they existed in that made so much sense for that moment and made a lot of sense to me when I was a kid watching them in the 90s, but also maybe it's because my brain was warped around that, like that became my standard, you know, but I do think for a lot of kids, it's just like, they don't even understand the things that the Muppets are riffing on to a certain degree, which is why I do think, like, making it more Flight of the Conchords, I'm fine with that, because I don't think you're going to succeed trying to make what Jim would have made. And I think you need to bring new voices in there.
But I think to your, you know, kind of original point, your unifying theory of the Muppets, which if I cut you off midstream, let's get back to it, because it's wonderful. the Muppet, the Jason Segel Muppet movie is the kind of thing that bothers me to my core, because it exists in a nether world, right? It exists in a nether world where Kermit is the Kermit who in his world is a star.
Yes. You brought me back. Yes.
All right. They are trying to wrap around. It's like, it's that moment in Matrix Reloaded.
Yes.
When he stops the ship in Zion.
Mm-hmm.
That should have led to everything being a Matrix, but didn't, and then took me out of it and said, what are you guys actually doing here?
So I'm so glad you brought this up, Kenny. Okay, thank you. You got me back on track, actually.
Okay, please.
So that's the big departure with those two movies. They are the first things in the Muppet canon since The Muppet Show to take place in the world of The Muppet Show, if that makes sense. So the idea is that
Tonight kind of did, right?
Oh, yes.
It had a Larry Sanders vibe, right?
Fair enough. So, yes. No, but that falls into that.
But that's okay to me. That's okay to me. Yeah.
Right. The difference with the Siegel movies is that they are. This is now not. You're right. I mean, look, it's towing a really, really tricky line. What the modern Disney Muppet movies are trying to do is those previous movies you've seen are movies that the Muppets made. This is now a movie about the Muppets who made movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me tell you what it'd be like.
That's what they're trying to say. It's like you previously were watching Mary Poppins, and now this is Saving Mr. Banks. So those two movies take place in a timeline where the Muppets had a TV show, then made a series of movies that did well at the box office and then progressively fell off, then went through a fallow period, and now they're living in the fallout of Muppets from Space. Like, for the sequel movie to make any sense, it has to be Muppets from Space happened 15 years ago.
I have to make one more point. I have to get this info.
Yeah. Okay, but I have
this
to
is what this is why it messes with my constitution.
Yes,
everything you said, but what they don't seem to realize that they're actually riffing on are making of documentaries.
Well, yes.
Making of mockumentaries. Okay,
sure.
So what this the logic that you're putting forth which is accurate, I totally buy it, calls for a making of mockumentary, not a slick produced, well-lit feature film that exists in a world where a mockumentary would make sense.
Okay. So within the population, within the you know, the court of public opinion, that movie did not do what they wanted it to do. It did all right. It was a decent hit, but it did not bring back the Muppets in the way they were hoping it would. I think that movie was a very risky Hail Mary pass where they're doing a lot of things that nearly break the entire universe of the Muppets in order to try to reset back to them being characters that everyone understands again. And their Hail Mary pass is, we've gone so far afield that we need to make a movie about what the Muppets mean to Muppets fans so we can have Muppet fans in the movie who have seen the other Muppet stuff recalibrating the Muppet canon. Which, in a certain way, I feel like that movie isn't discussed enough as being the first of what I now think has become a terrible trend, the give it back to the fans reboot-quel, if you will. The movie that's about characters living in the fallout of the movies that we love, who are also fans of those movies.
I have another point.
Your Force Awakens, your Ghostbusters Afterlife, this has now become the thing where it's like, the movie has to be not about bringing your favorite characters back. It has to be about making you feel good for being a fan of those characters. Because the heroes of the movie are now the people who love those characters.
And what you're supposed to do is what you did, which is at some point in your life, suck it up and acknowledge that you're going to be an adult fan. I remember the moment.
I don't need to be catered to. I'm a weirdo adult Muppet fan. I don't need to be catered to. I like both those movies, but I don't need to be suck up to in that way.
When I was 7, 8, 9, I hit Little Mermaid and I hit Aladdin. I was fucking happy about it.
Yeah.
And then, what was the one after? Fucking Lion King comes out, right?
Lion King.
Yeah.
Lion King comes out and I shun it because I'm too fucking cool go see a Disney movie.
Right.
And I missed the Lion King experience in the theater. Yeah. I felt so bad for myself. I said, you know what? I'm never going to do that again. I'm going to go see Pocahontas in the theater a good, weird adult.
Yeah.
And I did it. And I accepted it. I saw Hercules in the theater and all these horrible movies that came after it because I'm weird. And I don't need.
You got to own it. It's that shit when people say the Joker isn't a character for kids. The Joker's actually a homicidal maniac. And it's The Joker is a character for kids. He was created in Batman.
Oh, dude.
He sold bubble gum. I understand that across 80 years, there have been Joker stories told that are very violent and are not for children. There are a lot of them. But at his very essence, he was created as a comic book character, even if that was a dark character. And when I see people who tweet these things where they're just you think Batman's for kids? If a kid saw Batman v Superman, he would cry. It's actually very intense. And I'm like, why do you need that? Why do you need that? There are violent comic book stories I like, and there are comic book stories I like that are so fucking goofballs McGillicuddy. And if you like comic books, you need to be comfortable with the fact that you're reading a thing that was intentionally created for children. You cannot ask the property itself to make you feel better about it. You have to be comfortable with yourself and like whatever the fuck you like.
You are talking to an adult wrestling fan, okay?
Right.
And as an adult wrestling fan, I had to at some point be comfortable with the fact that this is underwear fighting for babies.
But the work's on you.
Good versus what's that?
Yes. No, but it's that's the thing. The work's on you. You got to come to terms with it. The thing doesn't have to make you feel better.
No. And you want to know what? Once you same with superheroes, same with the Muppets, same with
all
movies,
this stuff,
same with
I like this shit. I'm a little boy. I love all
that
this shit.
It's the good versus evil. It's the simple motivations. Right. Hopefully it's years and years and years of world building that your little baby brain gets excited about. But it's not. The time I was out on wrestling was when it became glass fighting and firefighting and all that shit. That I'm who is this for? Go away.
Can I just? I got to jump in for a second.
Sorry, Phil.
Don't apologize. Yeah. Don't apologize. I just want to pivot back to the Siegel Muppets movie for a second because I do think that it does.
And
feel
I like them both. I want to restate. I like them both.
I enjoyed them, but I do think that they're a fulcrum point. I do think they're sort of a fork in the road for the series, and Lord knows what happens now. But what that movie was trying to do, it juggles a lot of knots. Mm-hmm. And to its credit, it somehow keeps most of them in the air. Yes. In terms of tone, in terms of all the things it's trying to do. And it is trying to reboot the series. It's a little too self-aware for its own good. In fact, while promoting the Muppets movie, Kermit, while in Berlin, Germany, mm-hmm. promoting the film, Kermit on some radio station said, with all due respect to Muppets from Space, you don't want that to be your last movie ever. That's you so want to funny. Do a better one? So
I love that.
That is so Kermit.
Yeah.
It's so But it's like, God bless them yeah. for trying to turn the page
yeah.
and also living in their own selves to you and Kenny's mm-hmm. point. Like, this is Kermit being his true self yeah. and saying, like, yeah, we made a bad one. We're trying to make a better
one. We're trying to come back. And this is the other thing is, like, not just trying to reset the characters, reset the stage, yeah. create a new entry point, you know, bring back adults who grew up with them, get the new generation into them. I mean, that's what that movie's trying to do. But yeah. the main function of that movie seems to be, and Siegel himself said this, he was like, my number one goal was if this movie works, then that fall, the next fall, they put The Muppet Show on ABC 8 p.m. primetime. Right. And I think that is the explicit reason that movie takes place in the universe where the Muppets are the actors who have made all those previous films you've seen. Because he wants to get right. back to the iconography of the Red Curtain, them doing yeah. pop songs, like them having celebrity guests. Like, he wants to reset to that. And instead, they make another movie, which I think is better than the Siegel movie, The Muppets Most Wanted, which is Bobin and Stoller still, but Siegel has no mm-hmm. participation. I think that one's yeah. really good, but that one is in the same weird netherworld where it's like, well, now it's about them doing the Muppet Show touring across different countries, but it's still that iconography. But then they yep. still weren't doing the Muppet Show on ABC, and then they finally announced, oh, we're doing a new TV show. I went, thank God, this was all means to an end to get back to the TV show, the medium in which they probably work the best, variety sketch show, the one thing they could really fit into right now in the current climate, and instead they do the fucking, my least favorite Muppet thing ever made, The Muppets, yes. lowercase The Muppets, period, which was The Office meets, I mean, you said The Muppets Tonight was Larry Sanders,
right?
Yeah. Right, I mean, it's like, this yeah. is, they're, all... they all work on a late night talk show, and they're depressed, and they hate it, and it's a mockumentary. It's none of the Muppets are wacky, they're punching the clock. No, it's but awful. I know you're not.
I'm with you.
But
yeah.
this is just like Fozzie turning to the camera and complaining about traffic on the 101. And I'm like, this sucks. This is the fucking worst thing ever. And why are you going so far out of your way when the thing is right there? Just have them doing sketches. And so it's like, you know, Gonzo is like the talent booker or whatever. And Kermit's having an affair.
That's brutal.
Like, this stuff sucks. Well, and that feels like, that show feels like Muppets from Space bullshit. Where they're both half trying Muppets. To make them more adult and half being really childish.
It is Muppets from yep. Space bullshit. It's yeah. the same exact the same motivating strength. Factor, yeah. which is we are not cool.
Yes.
What's cool right now? Sinister. In 1999, yeah, yeah, it was like, you. Yeah. I mean, we say like, you know, Austin Powers. I felt like MTV Spring Break, right? Now, I know that was like yes. 6-7 years late, but that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It's that Uncle yep, it's yep. that Uncle Sam or Sam the Eagle scene you're talking about where I'm right. just like, what are we watching? Because it had yeah. that MTV vibe. It's very poochy to me.
Yes.
Same thing.
It's very poochy.
Same thing with trying to do the fucking Office. Right? Yeah. Like same yeah. thing, yeah. like trying to capture the zeitgeist when I think that they are just their own thing. Which is why I'm yeah. so taken with these Mickey cartoons. It's
yes. Well, because they're getting back to just like, you got to let the thing be the thing. And the thing the Mickey yeah. cartoons and the new Looney Tunes have in common is for the first time with these characters in who knows how long, it's like the animators are writing them. It's this mm-hmm. thing that now has finally oh. come back into fashion because of Adventure Time and some of the other Cartoon Network shows
yeah.
where they're like, you don't have WGA writers or non-WGA writers.
Right.
People not from animation backgrounds writing scripts that then they're handing off to other people to animate. You have animators sitting in a room together, coming up with stories, thinking primarily visual from the get-go. Mm-hmm. You know, the people writing the gags are the people who are going to draw them, or at least going to storyboard them. So you have that same thing where the Looney Tunes and Mickey Mouse are taking advantage of their mediums again, rather than just being stories that could technically be acted out on stage, live action, and not lose anything. They just happen to have these mascots attached to them. It's the same thing with the Muppets, where you're disconnecting the people who are performing the characters from the making of them. Muppets from Space is that. The Muppets, the TV show, is that. It's both are people who were Muppet adjacent, but weren't fully entrenched in it, trying to go like, I get the Muppets, but also I've sold some sitcoms. I should be the one to bridge the gap between these two, rather than it coming creatively from the inside.
Muppets from Space also makes the pretty colossal error of not making Kermit your lead.
Look, I'm fine with Kermit not being the lead of a story. I think it can survive, but it is bizarre how he just has nothing to do in this fucking movie.
Yeah. He doesn't have a story in this
He's
movie.
He's got nothing. He's got no personality. He's got no humor. He's got no narrative agency. He's got nothing to work with.
I'm going to give a synopsis real quick at the hour point, because it feels like the right time to do
I've done most of my table setting. We can dig into the movie itself.
So, with enormous enthusiasm and unsinkable optimism, Daredevil Gonzo steps into his first starring role in Muppets from Space, a hilarious extraterrestrial adventure, and also existential, about the search for Gonzo's past. On a quest with Buddy Rizzo to find his real family, Gonzo discovers that his long-lost relatives are actually aliens from a distant planet. It was written by Jerry Jewell, Joey Mazzarino, Ken Kaufman, directed by Tim Hill. We have you here, so we got to do our box office game real quick.
This is the lowest grossing by far.
Well, yeah. It opened fifth.
Yeah.
We're not going to, it opened on a Wednesday, technically, but we're going to do the Friday.
Was it 4th of July weekend or was it later in July?
It opened, it was in eighth place in that weekend. This is the weekend of July 16th, 1999. Okay. So it's not in the top five.
Yeah.
Your number one is
The Patriot.
Perhaps the most notorious movie from 1999.
Oh
no!
It's not Eyes Wide Shut, is it? No, that's June. Is it?
It is Eyes Wide Shut.
That's crazy that these movies were the same weekend.
You call that notorious?
I mean that in the
sure
best way.
You were talking about Wild Wild West.
I mean, that's a different type of notorious.
Fair. It's a different thing.
I'm sure you guys have
two,
talked about this, but there's the stat I remember from that summer as like a young budding box office aficionado that there were only two movies released all summer that opened at number one and didn't make $100 million. That summer was so big that almost everything, every weekend had a film that would go on to $100 million. And the only two were The Haunting, which got close. Right, terrible movie.
Very close.
But got close. Yeah. And Eyes Wide Shut, which had such a big drop-off. But everything else made it to 100 pretty much.
Yeah. Eyes Wide Shut, you know, listen, there's an argument to be made for whether or not that film should have been released in the fall. It probably should have been. It's not a summer movie.
It's a Christmas movie.
It's a Christmas
pointedly
movie.
Pointedly a
Christmas movie. So number two is, I think, the biggest, one of the biggest comedies of 1999.
Big Daddy?
Nope. That's
American
number
Pie?
Four. That's number two. Yes, American Pie is number two.
Three huge. You got Austin Powers, Big Daddy, and American Pie. Those are three big comedies that like cast a die for the next decade.
Yeah. And then at number three is, it's not really a horror movie. It's written by a TV guy, if that helps you. It's kind of a horror movie. It's a horror movie in that sort of like meta kind of post-Scream winkiness.
No, I know what it is.
I think Kenny might know what it is.
When you say TV guy, like a showrunner? Like an auteur of television?
Arguably, probably in the conversation for top five of all time, maybe, in terms of his abilities, or at least in terms of how many shows he made that were quite successful.
Yeah.
Also, I think it was directed by a TV guy as well. It stars... again, like there aren't really big stars in this movie either. It's kind of it's a movie that I think a lot of people actually kind of have reevaluated a little bit.
Give me the how much did it do this weekend? How much did it end up at domestically?
Oh, that's a very good question. Let me give you.
I don't think it's what I thought it was.
It might not be what you think it is, Kenny. I'm clicking on it right now. It ends up at 31 domestic.
Have we done it, Phil?
We have not done it yet.
Okay.
I do not believe it got an international release.
At all.
At all. It's a 20th Century Fox release.
Man, I feel like this is...
It's got a Golden Girl in it.
All the pieces are coming together for me. This isn't... is it Rue McClanahan?
No. It's definitely Betty White. There's no way Phil knows
it's
the other...
It's definitely Betty White.
Golden Girls. Oh,
is it Lake Placid?
It there is Lake Placid.
Okay.
Oh, that is what it is.
Okay.
David E. Kelly wrote that
other movie this year.
That's so fucking weird.
Mystery Alaska.
So that's what I was. All right, so there you go. Yeah.
So weird.
It's Bill Pullman and Bridget Fonda and a big crocodile.
Yeah. Wow.
And,
okay.
And then number five is what Kenny believes to be the most notorious film of 1999.
Wild Wild West.
Yes.
That's a rapid drop off. Yeah. Because that came out Big Willy weekend. This is like.
They thought that was going to be huge.
I believe that was the last Big Willy weekend.
That was for a little while. Yeah.
I mean, Wild Wild West, ultimately, in the greater scheme of things, wasn't actually a financial disaster as much as people think that it is.
No, it's one of those movies that no one lost money on, but everyone hated so much and the expectations were so high.
So high.
Yeah.
It does still, I think, have Kenny's favorite line of 1999 so far.
Oh, do you know? When was the last time you watched it, Griffin?
I probably have seen it in the last 5
21 years ago?
I've seen it within the last 5 or so years on streaming.
The line is when Will Smith kills a guy who's holding a machete at him, and
kicks him off the giant spider.
Uh-huh. Of the giant spider, and he says, "No more Mr. Knife Guy."
Wow. Well, speaking of great jokes. My understanding is that Columbia and Henson Pictures have this big deal. They know they want to do a new Muppet movie. They want to make something that feels a little more Gen X-y. They want to push the Muppets out of the territory they've been in. So there are all these stories of different pitches that were circulating at that time. There was some script that was called like Muppet Haunted House or something. There were a lot of these sort of like genre pastiches of like, can we put the Muppets in a new type of movie, a new environment? It boiled down to, do you know this? It boiled down to two final pitches for them to decide which one they were going to go with. And they were Muppets from Space, and I swear to God, this isn't a joke. The second choice was Muppets in Space. They had two rival pitches, and they were, as much as you guys are saying, putting them in space doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, they were so squarely fixated on the idea of, I don't care if it's that they were from there originally, or they're from here and they're going there, but we're making some kind of fucking Muppet space movie. And there is still, I'm going to post it in the chat for you guys to see.
Please,
there is
please
still
do.
Here this this weird item, Welch's Grape Jelly, had a series of commemorative jars that are merchandise for a movie that was never made. They're Muppets in Space jars. They came out, I think, earlier the same year that Muppets from Space came out. And it is just the Muppets in space suits on alien planets. They were going to make like a space exploration movie. I think part of it was tied to that there was such a big resurgence of sci-fi in the second half of the 90s that you had Men in Black and Independence Day and X-Files and the Star Wars special editions that it felt like maybe that's a thing to glom onto them. But
I'm surprised you don't own one of these collectible jelly glasses.
I've been looking on eBay. I've decided I want to get one set. In my research for this episode, I've been...
Yeah, sure.
I have some searches for these jars.
It's just an absurd thing. The making of on the iTunes disc or whoever the fuck knows which one it is. But there's a moment when Reiner's talking about how he broke up with Patty Marshall and he was sad. And then he saw that Michelle Pfeiffer was newly single. So he thought, hey, maybe I'll go out with Michelle Pfeiffer. Totally serious. Yes. Like says it in a way that makes me go like, you actually think you're going to date Michelle Pfeiffer? It was insane.
You married David E. Kelly. Come on.
Yeah.
Anyway,
okay. I'm going to restart recording.
Yeah, of course. David E. Kelly. Come on.
So they're in this arms race between Muppets from Space and Muppets in Space. And I've never read too much about what Muppets in Space was supposed to be other than that they were supposed to be in space. The other pitches sound very sort of vague. But the Muppets from Space pitch won out, it sounds like, from all the other things that were being thrown out, because it felt like it had some tie to the original thing, which is the best scene in the original right. Muppet movie is Gonzo looking up at the stars and saying, I hope I go back there someday.
Yeah, yeah.
The
defining
moment of the character. Yeah. And they went like, well, there's this thing, this lingering thing about Gonzo being a whatever, being the one thing of an indistinguishable species. He's got this song that feels a little space-like. Maybe there's something there. For me, fundamentally, yes, there's some emotional territory there. That falls classically into question I don't need answered ever.
Well, answered.
Right.
Totally.
But that wins the arms race of what's the next Muppet movie, because they feel like, well, we're playing in a genre that's popular. We can do it in a modern setting. If it's not in space, we can have them existing in a modern world rather than the last two films, which have been period pieces, a storybook film.
Right.
And this Gonzo thing, giving Gonzo a chance to be the lead. This is the other thing, is at this point, Gonzo is kind of the one character still being played by the original person who heavily developed him, right? Like the last of the original guys, because you have Steve Whitmire's taken over for Kermit. So Kermit is now second generation Kermit. Frank Oz in this movie just dubbed over the voices. He did not do any puppeteering. He did like half and half on Muppet Treasure Island. On this one, he does nothing. He has not put his hand in a puppet. So you have other puppeteers playing the characters live on set and him essentially just doing ADR, which I think feeds into why the performances are all badness. With all due respect to Frank Oz, when he like is doing like Q&As and events and stuff, I've seen him speak and people say, can you do the Miss Piggy voice? He will always say, I can't do the voice. It's not just a voice for me. It's a performance. It's a physical thing. It's tied to the puppet. I don't know if he had the puppet on him when he was doing ADR. I don't know what his process was, but he himself very much speaks about how it's a fluid, full body thing and he can't just do it. And this movie is essentially asking him to just layer those voices on. And so A, he's having to match what someone else did on the day, making different choices. And B, it's like, he's not really there working with the other people.
I think there's also, I mean, so it's funny you bring up Frank Oz, because watching this film, first of all, Miss Piggy does feel a little bit just not like she's clicking in the way that she does in the other films.
I'm sorry, but like Fozzie has like almost nothing to do. Like all the Frank Oz characters kind of are...
They're kind of...
They sideline the three classic Muppet characters.
Animal, Fozzie, and Piggy are his big three. Yeah.
It also makes me think about, and I don't know if you've read this, but... when they were making the score, the Frank Oz directed movie with the...
These are my favorite on-set stories.
Marlon Brando refused to take any direction from Frank Oz and just kept calling him Miss Piggy on set.
I
saw that movie recently. It's a lot better than
it's not great.
Be. Yeah.
It's not bad.
It's fine.
It's not bad.
It's and so I'm a big Oz fan.
It's so weird it was Frank Oz who pulled that cast together.
I know.
But
yeah, that was the story that De Niro had an earpiece and Frank Oz on set would speak into the earpiece and then De Niro would give Brando Frank Oz's directions but try to make them sound like they were just like, hey, can I give you a little advice? It's insane.
It's so crazy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So Muppets from Space, just to give a little bit of critical context, had 63% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 58% from audiences, which feels generous on both sides. Roger Ebert gave it 2 out of 4 stars. I'm going to read a little bit of his review. He said, "The new Muppets movie lacks the kind of excitement the first ones generated, maybe because Muppets have become a little dated except for younger viewers, or maybe because the kind of animals we've seen in the two Babe movies show such an advance in special effects that we almost wonder why the Muppeteers go to all that trouble to physically manipulate their creatures. I feel guilty even writing these words. I recall the charm of the original Muppet movie when Kermit actually rode a bicycle and we all gasped. I suppose it seemed then that the Muppets could continue indefinitely with their outsized personalities and effortless interaction with human characters. But now, well, maybe it's just this movie. Maybe Muppets from Space is not very good. Maybe they'll make a comeback. I hope so." Now, the LA Times, however, really liked
this. Phil, before you go on, I want to make...
Lest anyone be worried that the folks...
Can you hear me?
Phil, before you go on, I want to make one point about that Roger Ebert review. I think it's really interesting. He said he felt guilty for giving it a lukewarm review. And I... I think there's something to that, right? Within the last 10 years, I was a huge baseball fan growing up, but I no longer am a baseball fan anymore. And I realized what was bringing me back, and it was nothing but nostalgia and guilt, right? Where I felt like in some way I was letting down. I still have a baseball poster behind me, as you can see, but in some way I was letting down generations of, you know, men before me by not being super into this sport anymore. Yeah. And I think there's something to that with the Muppets a little bit. And I could extend that to this Jason Segel movie to some extent. Which, you know, there's something that really bothered me about that movie, like at its core. And I this is going to sound so stupid, but Griffin, I have a feeling you're going to get it.
Sure.
Your point about the fan service of it plays very well with me, because I do think that's what's going on there. But I think they made a critical error. Now, I don't know if it would have played if Walter was a human. Mm-hmm. By making Walter a Muppet, mm-hmm. and a Muppet fanboy, mm-hmm. it played as if Walter was part of this very small minority group mm-hmm. who only liked the Muppets because they were the best representation of that minority group.
Yes.
Whereas what it really was Jason Segel, a human being, mm-hmm. expressing his love for the Muppets. And it may have played better that way, because I remember seeing this
without the Walter character. You're saying it's just Amy Adams and Jason Segel, and there's no Walter. Everything that Walter does could be done through a human being.
It may have been better, because I would have understood it a little better, instead of making it feel like, you know, this person is like me, therefore I like
him. I agree with that.
I remember my niece to it, who was 5 or 6 at the time, mm-hmm. and it played horribly on her. She hated
Oh,
she hated every second of it. She wanted to leave, and I forced her to stay because I'm a great uncle. But I think that might have been part of it. I think it felt like these were creatures for creatures, not creatures for people.
Well, yes, and I think that's another weird thing where it's like, how many of these questions do you want to start asking? Because then things start to unravel quickly in a world that is not defined by these types of rules. Mm-hmm. But you start to go like, so what is a Muppet exactly in relation to the rest of society? Because the Muppets are not a species. There are Muppets who are frogs, but there are also real world frogs. And there are Muppets who are bears, but there are also real world bears. Like in Muppets Take Manhattan, Fozzie goes and hibernates with realistic looking bears. And Fozzie the bear looks very different than Bobo the bear, who is less stylized. And there are Muppets who are humans. You know, there are Muppets who are totally humanoid, like the Muppet Newsman, for example. Yeah. And I guess ostensibly a lot of the Electric Mayhem is like, they're not supposed to be an animal other than animal, who is no specific animal, right? So all this stuff like gets a lot more complicated. And even just like Rolf is a dog, but then Piggy has a pet dog. And that dog is a puppet, but it behaves like a dog and not like an anthropomorph, all this shit. You just don't want to get into it. Which, and so that becomes this thing of like, right. So then Walter, you go like, so then what is a Muppet? Like, because my understanding of it always was like, well, the Muppet, a character being in felt is a representation of they're a weirdo. they're an oddball. This is all Jim Henson's metaphor for the creative type, the performer type, right? This sort of like the circus freaks, the comedians, you know, the divas, the grips. I mean, all these people who just want to be living that sort of carnival lifestyle and show business. And that's, I think, what they're trying to do with Walter is like, well, he doesn't know the Muppets. He's had his own life completely removed from the Muppets, but he relates to them because they speak to something in him because he's also made of felt. But the only thing...
It should also be said, too, that the Muppet or a Man song yes. muddies all of that,
absolutely.
Too.
It gets very complicated. Good song. Good number.
Good but song, but what the fuck's happening?
I've spent the better part of a decade now trying to untangle it. So right, Muppets from Space is sort of trying to get into those questions again. Now, I will say, I think the single best part of this movie is the opening.
Yeah.
Because I loved it when I was 10 at the time. I surprisingly loved it. And then...
The Noah's Ark thing?
No, the whole movie. Yeah. When I was 10, when I saw it and I was kind of embarrassed to see it, I loved it. And I was like, Muppets are back, baby. Still funny. And then... Within a couple of years, when I had made that decision of like, I'm a serious adult Muppet fan, without rewatching that movie, I was like, I think that movie sucks. And I pretty much held on to the belief that this movie sucks for the last 20 years, despite maybe not seeing it in full since then. Now, in the last couple of years, I've started to see people defend it. And a lot of the serious adult Muppet fans hated this movie at the time. This was viewed as the nadir. It still gets talked about as the nadir. Every time anyone presents a new Muppet project, it's like what Kermit said on the radio show. Hey, look, we all are sorry for Muppets from Space. We're not going to do that again, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. I started seeing people I respect defend it. You know, people around my age, people a little younger than me or whatever. And I was like, am I wrong about this? Am I too harsh on it? Do I need to be more open-hearted? So I rewatched it for this with that in mind. And I got to the opening scene. I like that opening scene a lot. When it's not being talked about in literal terms, because this opening scene is the nightmare that Gonzo keeps having. That F. Murray Abraham himself is Noah, and they're letting all the animals onto the ark, and he won't let Gonzo on the ark because there's only one of him.
It's lovely. Right.
That's lovely. And that, for me, I go, that's good thematic ground for a movie. And especially because you have Jerry Nelson is still alive, but he's getting old, and he's only playing a lot of the supporting characters, like Floyd Pepper and stuff. Frank Oz is going to be dubbing this in later. Steve Whitmire, second generation. The other two big guys you have are Bill Beretta, who plays like Pepe and Bobo and a lot of the new characters and plays some of the old legacy characters. And the other guy's name, I think, is Bill Prady. Am I getting that right? Bill Prady is the one who did the other show. The show
Big
I named.
Big Bang Theory?
Yes. No, and he did the Muppets lowercase period. Right. So it's Bill Whitmire, Beretta. And Frank Oz are the main Muppeteers in this. Then with Jerry Nelson doing a little bit, Brian Henson doing a little bit, Kevin Clash pretty much only playing Clifford. So I think it's also smart to go, Dave Golds is the guy who's still kind of got skin in the game from the original crew, is showing up every day, plays a primary character, build it around him. He's an emotional fulcral point. But then once the movie starts, like in earnest, after this Noah's Ark thing, it just becomes like, okay, so they all live in a house together in like Southern California? Like, what is this reality? What do they mean to each other now? Because every other version of it, once again, I don't care about continuity, but every time they've established a new backstory to who the Muppets are to each other and how they know each other, it kind of makes sense with their personality types in the way that it's like, oh, Muppets Take Manhattan goes, these Muppets all went to college together. They were all drama nerds at college, and then they met some of the other Muppets when they moved to New York and tried to put on a Broadway show. And the Muppet movie is everyone building up one by one. And The Great Muppet Caper is finding a job that would fit for each Muppet and having the Happiness Hotel, which is like a flop house for Muppets and all these weirdos. But then this one is just like, this is the one that for me breaks the reality the most, even more than the sequel ones of what you're saying, Kenny, where I'm like, are these the same Muppets who have starred in movies and put on shows? Because at one point they talk about, this is our vacation. So is this supposed to be like their summer home that they're renting, where the entire stock company of the Muppets, all 50 of them, are renting one house together? and just brushing their teeth to Brick House by the Commodores. Like, what the fuck is this?
It's
terrible.
I would actually say that the moment that kind of, when I was like, oh, this isn't going to be good, honestly, was the first music sequence. Because that's when I realized, oh, shit, they're not going to do original songs.
No, this sucks. And they wrote original songs. Ween had written an original song that I think ended up on one of their albums. There's a recording of Gonzo doing a modern version of I Hope I Go Back There Someday that has been released in some other capacity. They had them. They were never shot. But that's the other thing about this movie is they had a script. Jerry Jewell did some of the writing, but the main writer, it sounds like, was a guy who I believe his name was Brian Mazzarino. Joey Mazzarino, I apologize, who later became the head writer of Sesame Street and has been the head writer of Sesame Street for a long time. At this point, he had done a lot of stuff with the Muppets, but he was also kind of like a hot new writer in town and had been selling spec scripts and working for different studios and stuff. And so he had done stuff with Sony. He had done stuff with the Muppets. They said, you'd be a good fit for this after this pitch, the Dave Gold's pitch of we answer the Gonzo question. Is Gonzo an alien? So he said he wrote a lot of the script. There's an interview with him from Tough Pigs, which is like the best adult Muppet fan site. They did a long interview with him, maybe 2005, where he goes into the making of all this. And he said that he wrote the whole script. He was pretty proud of it. It was trying to riff on as many of these sort of current sci-fi movies of their day, which your opinion of parodies, you know, it's personal. But I also think this movie probably works better if it's a pastiche of different sci-fi movies rather than whatever the fuck this is. But he said pointedly his movie was about the fact that the alien thing was a red herring. That he thought Gonzo should be unanswered. I'm skipping to the end of the movie here, but it was supposed to be that when the aliens land and he sees the other aliens and Gonzo thinks, oh, I'm finally going to get an answer as to who I am, they tell him that they are aliens who, much like the aliens in Galaxy Quest the same year, saw broadcasts of the Muppet Show on their ship.
Oh, wow.
And they decided they're really hideous aliens and they decided to remodel themselves after Gonzo. And there's a moment where they like hit a button and, much like in Galaxy Quest, they become like disgusting squid blobs. And they just came to Earth because they want to thank Gonzo for giving them inspiration. And Gonzo has this sort of existential crisis, but then realizes the journey of the movie has been him realizing that he doesn't need to question who his family is because he has the family of the Muppets.
That's better.
What the movie is.
Undeniably better.
And it also feels like that's what the movie is designed to be. But they were supposed to make this movie with Randall Kleiser, who is the director of Grease, and also Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, and also a very weird collection of movies. The two Blue Lagoon movies, very weird filmography. He's supposed to make it with that guy's script, and then Sony freaks out, and they go, he doesn't have a vision, we have to fire him. So they hire instead Tim Hill, who had done some puppet stuff, mostly came from an animation background, later goes on to direct Garfield, A Tale of Two Kitties, and Alvin and the Chipmunks. Not
your favorite movie.
Not my favorite filmmaker. Right. But he jumped on and he's got a very kiddie sensibility. And then he says, I don't like all of the stuff in the script. I think he should be an alien. I think we should take out all these parodies. I think we should take out all of this.
Right.
And so Brian Mazzarino, or Joey Mazzarino, I apologize, quit. He said, I just didn't want to be part of it anymore.
Okay.
And I question whether that was the right decision, if it would have been better for me to stay on set and try to fight the battles on a daily basis. I never got hired to write a screenplay ever again. It definitely feels like it burned a lot of bridges in the industry by me doing that. But I disown that movie and I'm really unhappy with what ended up coming out with it. And so, yeah, it's what we got today, which is then the musical numbers are no longer in it. It's all funk songs. Gonzo is an alien at the end, but he doesn't want to go back home to them. All this stuff that feels really muddled sounds like it came about in this sort of like 3-month rush with a new director to reconceptualize most of the movie.
Yeah, it does feel like from a story perspective, and Kenny, you texted me this when I think we were both watching it either around the same time or whatever, and you were just like, too much Rizzo. And I was like, yeah, too much Rizzo. Like,
that's how Rizzo. Too much Rizzo, too much
Rizzo's
Pepe.
Got like...
They're horrible.
Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about. It's like, Rizzo is Whitmire's character. He plays Kermit, but Rizzo's the one that he developed that he has authorship over. Pepe is being played by someone who has authorship over them. Gonzo, played by someone who has authorship over them. The rest of the characters, they're like, this is them testing out, like, can we phase some of these Muppets out?
Yeah. And it didn't work.
Yeah.
I think that's
no.
So I understand the nobility of that, and I understand the utility of that.
Yes,
but,
sure.
But it's such a failure to me. And look, I hate Rizzo in Muppets Take Manhattan.
You're not there's a Rizzo fan. Okay, fair enough.
There's something about that character that I find truly revolting.
But you're a New Yorker. New Yorkers like Rizzo.
truly find him physically disgusting.
No, I like Rizzo. He is a grading character by design. Yeah. He looks gross, and his personality is abrasive.
He looks gross. I always have had a problem with all the fraggly Muppets.
Sure.
That's not what I want out of a Muppet. I'm far mm-hmm. more partial if you're going to give me new Muppets. I think Bobo's design is literally hilarious.
I think Bobo's great. And Pepe definitely falls into your Rizzo valley, both in appearance and in personality. Pepe's a real Rizzo. I know a Rizzo when I see one. Pepe is a Rizzo.
Pepe is the multiplicity fourth copy of Rizzo.
Correct.
You know? So at that point, I already got my Rizzo. And
yeah,
fine, I can handle it, but don't give me a copy of a copy. So, yes, I don't want too much Rizzo. I don't want too much Pepe.
I agree with you. I think Bobo's great, both in terms of the puppet. It's a new look. He's a new size. He's got a good personality. He's got good games. It's good performance. Yeah. And it's telling that he is the only Muppet in this movie of the new Muppets that were presented. Well, A, who has an arc, and B, is still used.
It makes it.
He's still used. I mean, he's in the sequel movies. He's in, like, they still consider him. Pepe gets used very sparingly. I think he has one line in Muppets Most Wanted and appears in a crowd scene. I mean, Rizzo is not in the sequel movies really at all. He's in Muppets Most Wanted again for, like, a millisecond. But Bobo, they hold on to because Bobo plays. Bobo works. Yeah.
I will say this, though. Pepe is in a lot of the reviews. Critics really liked Pepe. Pepe seemed to be the one who popped for
absolutely
them.
Pepe had a big summer, and when they sell to the German company, they front load Pepe for a number of years after this. I mean, this is the dark ages of the Muppets, but Pepe becomes the spokesperson for Long John Silver's. So Pepe is part of a national advertising campaign.
That's insane.
They start making a lot of Pepe merchandise.
Those are his brothers and sisters. Great. Are you kidding?
What fans would call the Big Five, right? The idea is that the Muppets, the Big Five, is always Kermit, Piggy, Fozzie, Gonzo, and then the fifth one rotates at different times.
Right.
In the earlier days, it was Rolf. Then it later becomes Animal, you know, through sort of popularity. Yeah. Rizzo definitely had his moment in the Big Five, the period you're talking about in the early 90s, post-Muppets Take Manhattan.
Yeah,
and then after this, they were like Pepe's Big Five. Pepe was part of everything they fucking did. If the Muppets made any appearance on anything, Pepe was part of it. They made a couple Christmas specials, Pepe was part of it. They did Muppet Wizard of Oz, Pepe was Toto. Like, Pepe, they were just so ready to make... Pepe was their Taylor Kitsch. They were front-loading him. They were so confident it was going to happen. But what's interesting is, yes, at the time, I remember seeing this movie in theaters, and the screening I went to, audiences went ballistic over Pepe. And the reviews said, Pepe is the only one who's funny. Like, he came out of this as the only one that people were laughing at. And I don't think it holds up terribly well today. But at the time, it was like, this guy feels a little fresh. This is something new.
But is Pepe not just those weird little aliens in Men in Black in the kitchen?
Isn't that the same? Very similar. Yes.
Like, they sound the same. They've got very similar mannerisms.
Now, I think it's parallel thinking because Muppets Tonight, I believe, is 96 or 97, right around the same time as Men in Black
is 97.
Yeah, but Pepe was originally, if I could go into this for half a second.
Please.
Bobo was Bobo. He was the character he is, the security guard character. That's how he was used on Muppets Tonight. It would be the bit of when the celebrities came to the studio to record their episode. Mm-hmm. To film, Bobo would be the security guard who checked them in, and it was easily starstruck and easily confused. And a big softy. Seymour and Pepe were like bellboys? Or they were like ushers? They had little like usher outfits. I haven't seen the show in a while because it's still never been released on DVD, never put on Disney Plus. But it was two characters. They were a comedy team. It was Seymour and Pepe. And Seymour
happened to Seymour?
Gone! Erased! this is important, I think, is that like
it is,
Pepe
it is,
was
yeah.
very much designed as part of a two-person act. You know, it was like Pepe Seymour was like, he was a big elephant and he had a really cartoony voice, and they would have a song and dance. They would have a song they would do together. And it was like the little guy and the big guy, and the one guy's positive and the other guy's sarcastic and whatever.
It's a Laurel and Hardy bit.
Right. And then they just, they threw Seymour in the fucking trash and they went like, Pepe's a star. And it's very bizarre, especially as you said, in a movie that already is foregrounding Rizzo so much. After the last two movies foregrounded Rizzo so much. I mean, both Muppets Treasure Island and Muppet Christmas Carol make Gonzo and Rizzo a team. They are a team. So Rizzo has become very prominent now in all this stuff. And in Muppets Tonight, he's very prominent. And then you're going like, we're going to extract Pepe from his own two-person team and just kind of make him another Rizzo, but without the closeness to any other character.
It just, it felt very, I mean, as you said, the tone is very similar. Their look is very similar. It just feels like they're doubling down on something that's just unnecessary.
Little
but I also
wise.
Think that just, and you know, not to beat a dead horse, but it does feel like, you know, by going all in on Gonzo, by going all in on this storyline, it's really sort of set them adrift, right? And they don't, so, and it, the whole thing really feels just very sort of misguided and kind of all over the place. So it doesn't shock me that they're kind of reaching for whatever they can reach for in the hopes that it'll bring some sort of cohesion to it. I mean, early in the film, you got basically Gonzo turning to Kermit and saying, like, I'm tired of being a whatever. I'm tired of feeling like this. Kermit calls him distinct, which I think is great. Mm-hmm. It's a great way of describing him. And then we have sort of this, like, the aliens trying to communicate with Gonzo.
Right. He gets struck by lightning. He has the fish.
Well, the cereal had this,
right.
This, like, messages stuff. And then he's struck by lightning. And the striking, the lightning sequence is legitimately frightening to me.
Yeah. It's
like, it's really weird.
Yes.
He's like, it's like a Christ pose situation. And then he's traveling through space in this, like, It's very strange.
It seems a little
not
more Sesame Street than Muppets to me in its own weird way.
A little bit.
You know?
But, but also
that.
it's this kind of like, it is something of a J.J. Abrams mystery box approach to storytelling, which is like the first 30 minutes of this movie, we're going to make you think that something insane is going to happen by the end of the film. Like, here are all these ominous signs. Here are all these characters who are showing up and giving a message and saying, I can't tell you more yet. But you'll find out soon enough.
Yep.
And then the movie really kind of just like stalls. It taxis for a majority of its runtime.
It does. I mean, you've got a lot of, it's just a lot of treading water in storylines like Miss Piggy. So Gonzo's lured to a news station, which he thinks is a message from space. And Miss Piggy's working there and she's trying to become a newscaster and to steal Andy McDowell's spotlight.
Right. Miss Piggy just wants to be a local newswoman.
It doesn't, for what reason? I mean,
it's
I don't
beneath
know.
Her.
Right.
It is. Yeah. And then you've got like, you've got Josh Charles showing up in this Men in Black sort of parody thing. I don't know how I feel about Josh Charles punching the hell out of Miss Piggy. Even if she does win the fight, it's not a
but
great
a
look.
A lot of that stuff feels for me like this is very much a childish movie, but they're finding these couple of moments where they're like, can we push things 2 degrees so that like, parents in the audience are like, whoa, this Muppet movie is like a little bit fucked up.
I will second that, Phil. I thought I was a little fucked up seeing the sweetest man in Hollywood, Josh Charles,
very strange,
beat the shit out of America's sweetheart, who is made of felt and a woman and a pig.
It's also one of those things where like Piggy always has been a fighter. She always does karate.
She's a fighter.
There are always fight scenes. But it's one of those things where it's like, you can't punch back. The second,
no one lays a glove on her. That's always Piggy's thing. And that was that's what I was going to ask you about
the second
that.
Anyone punches her.
That's what I was going to ask you about the Andy McDowell fight, because I can't remember. Look, my knowledge of the Muppets is basically the three movies, a lot of the Muppet Show and, you know, Muppet Babies and things along that lines. I cannot remember Miss Piggy ever losing a fight, and she definitively loses of all people to Andy McDowell.
I don't think she's ever lost a fight before this movie, and she takes 2 big L's.
No, she beats Josh Charles.
eventually.
But she loses to Andy McDowell.
Yeah. Yeah.
So can I ask, this is a bigger question, which this will hit a good chunk of the plot. Okay. The cameos in this movie.
So bizarre. I wanted to bring this up next. Great. Okay. Great. Yes.
What is going on with the cameos in this movie?
My favorite place in New York City used to be a bar called Videology, where they had an incredible movie trivia night, which is the only reason I have a podcast now, came out of that. But they would let someone host a guest round every week. And I did a guest round on Muppet movies. And I tried to do one question for each movie. And my question for Muppets from Space, which I think maybe no one got right, was like, which of these cameos is not in Muppets from Space? I guess some people got it right. It was multiple choices. Some people got it right, but it was amazing disproportionately how few people got it right. Because I put in David Duchovny, and I was like, if you haven't seen this movie and you hear the title Muppets from Space and you know it's from 1999, it's safe to assume that's the kind of thing that would make sense for the Muppets to do. To have a scene where David Duchovny and or Gillian Anderson show up, right? Mm-hmm. And instead, I was like, no, the other three options are Rob Schneider, Hollywood Hogan, and F. Murray Abraham. And then you add on Josh Charles, Annie McDowell, Ray Liotta, Kathy Griffin. It's a very bizarre grouping
Katie
of
Holmes,
people.
Josh Jackson.
Katie Holmes, Joshua Jackson.
Characters.
Right.
Playing Pacey and Joey.
They exist in the same universe.
I know.
They're in the same universe.
They talk about Dalton not being there. Yeah. Like, they clearly wrote a cameo around the fact that they were hoping they would get James Vanderbeek.
Yeah.
So instead, they have the other two actors talk about the fact that James Vanderbeek isn't in the movie, essentially.
And by the way, they were the ones who were slumming at that point.
I know. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's also, so they shot it on the same soundstage, which is why they just basically knocked on their door and was like, hey, will you fucking show up for 5 minutes?
But it is like, says,
no way.
That's like a grouping of people who are at very different stages in their career.
Yes.
The different ways in which they use those people, even in terms of how they present them, like someone like Josh Charles, you're like, is the audience seeing a Muppet movie in 1999 going to recognize Josh Charles with sunglasses over his face as a cameo, or is that just an actor being cast in a role? Like, is that supposed to be in the tradition of Muppet cameos, or is that just a day player, you know?
I think that these cameos really speak to how much of the shine was off the Muppets
absolutely
at this point, right?
Yes.
Because these are the people that are like, yeah, sure, I'll do a day on the Muppet movie, right? And all of it just screams sort of, it's kind of sad, is ultimately what it is.
But
Ray Liotta's cameo is insane.
Ray Liotta is bizarre.
Two of the human cameos are to set up sexual tension with specific Muppets, right? I mean, Liotta wants to fuck Piggy, and it's implied that Kathy Griffin does fuck Animal.
Yeah.
I think she does.
But I think part of the charm of the Muppet movies, at least the first three, is that the cameos are never the biggest stars in the world. They're always kind of just the biggest stars at that moment.
Well, and also they're people who fit into the Muppet universe.
Yeah, they're always a little
like Steve Martin and Elliot Gould, even though they were big stars at that moment, they fit.
Yeah.
They're very
Steve McQueen being in a Muppet movie would have been jarring. But Gould and Martin fit. But also Milton Berle and Bob Hope and
Orson Welles, Edgar Bergen,
these are all
something about people who have a tie, whether it is an actual tie or a spiritual tie
to
a different kind of comedy, really.
Right? But as you said, you have a bunch of cameos in which people are just playing characters, and then you have two big stars playing the same characters they play on a TV show, establishing that TV show now exists in the same universe as this movie. And then you have Hollywood Hogan, credited with his name
Hollywood
at
Hogan.
That time. Like, not Hulk Hogan, but Hollywood Hogan, because this was his fucking WCW heel turn.
Happy
era.
To dive into this one if you'd like me to.
But he comes on screen and direct addresses the camera and essentially explains what his narrative is in wrestling at that time. Like, the movie breaks for a moment in order for him to continue his rebranding tour of, I'm a bad guy now, watch WCW.
It's extremely fucking weird.
Weird.
Because I'm going to do a quick Hulk Hogan
please.
Deep dive.
Yeah.
It'll be a shallow dive. The Hulk Hogan thing, Griffin, I'm amazed you know as much as you know on this.
My brother was a big WCW kid at the time.
All right. So basically, Hulk Hogan spent his entire career in WWF as a good guy, the goodest of all good guys.
Yeah.
He goes to WCW. His good guy act is not playing that well in Atlanta, where WCW is based. Now, it's a national company, but it's basically a southern regional company that hates WWF. And they think he is coming to steal their guy's spot. So the fans reject him.
They don't want the sloppy seconds from the league that they already weren't following.
Right. So good for everybody in this situation, from Hogan to Ted Turner to everybody, to read the writing on the walls and say, you know what? He's a bad guy here. We're going to make him a bad guy in real life. And they lean into the fact that he came from up north and that he was been in these Hollywood movies. And that, like, you know, Hulk Hogan before The Rock was as big as wrestlers got. So he had these Hollywood friends. He looks like he does in this movie with his – what's that?
He's a coastal elite.
He's a coastal – yeah, he is.
He's a latte liberal. Well, actually, he's not, but he is a coastal elite,
He dyes his beard black, starts calling himself Hollywood Hogan, forms this bad guy group called the NWO, legitimately the coolest thing wrestling has ever done in America. Front to back, that I can go for a while, and Phil, we will, because it happened around 1999. But the thing about this cameo that's so super weird is no art form in the world protects their reality more than wrestling.
Yes.
Hollywood, forget Hollywood Hogan. The Undertaker, an undead zombie mortician, goes on Jay Leno as the Undertaker and tries to present the reality of wrestling as his reality in the real world.
You don't break kayfabe.
You do not break kayfabe. That's right. Hulk Hogan broke kayfabe in Muppets from Space.
Right, to talk about the way he was rebranded.
Yes, to say I'm a bad guy now.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Shortly thereafter this, Rizzo and Gonzo are kidnapped and put into like a rat training.
Right, because Gonzo is forced to make a bunch of messages. He mows the lawn and he goes on the talk show. He's trying to communicate to them. But talking about the sort of lack of narrative propulsion in this movie, the premise is essentially Gonzo is told that the aliens are going to arrive in a couple of days. And then the movie has to tread water until the aliens arrive. The only thing matters.
Worst setting the Muppets have ever been in.
Visually.
Talk about that for a second?
Building. Yes, it's the worst. Awful.
Well, it's first of all, it is visually. It's also kind of fucked and scary because it's about doing like surgeries and medical research on rats and these characters that we love. I mean, no joke.
You love.
We get like,
hey,
whatever. all right, but we're like seconds away from Gonzo being cut open by that.
Right, and here's another like universe shattering thing. I really care, but that character is Dr. Phil Von Neuter, who is played by Brian Henson, and Dr. Phil Von Neuter was a regular on Muppets Tonight. It was sort of the attempt to make a new version of Muppet Labs. Bunsen Honeydew and Beaker were still there, but they were trying to refresh everything. So it was, instead of it being a science lab, it's like a mad scientist and he does these things.
Sure.
And it was
Dr.
Phil Von Neuter and he had a hunchback named Lurch. And then this movie is saying, like, this isn't the Muppets playing roles in a movie. This is ostensibly the real lives of the actors, the Muppets, who have starred in things we know. But then also this guy who they used to be on a TV show with is now just a villain who they seemingly don't know, who's about to lobotomize them.
I want to say one thing.
It's
a bit of a callback. This is much worse than the Jason Segel Muppets. So I don't want anyone to think
like
that
both of those. Yeah.
This is, I actually like them too.
Yes. But you're saying, yes. This
I
is
like,
far and away
I
the
like
worst
them thing. Too in their own way. I think they're kind of lovely. I think the Jason Segel one, you know, if you can kind of like distill the heart of that movie into like something you can drink, it would taste good.
Yes.
But this movie, this movie is a disaster. Yes. It's a disaster on every level. And particularly from the reality of the world perspective.
At this point, we do get a cameo that I think actually works, which is David Arquette.
Oh, right.
David Arquette shows up.
Another former WCW champion.
But yeah, but he feels like he belongs.
He
in
knows
a Muppet
he's
movie
in a Muppet movie.
Me.
He seems like the he one guy it. In this who is doing it because he's like, I've always wanted to be in a Muppet movie.
It feels that yes. way. It feels that way. So we have that whole thing in the. It's basically just, it's kind of a heist movie at this point because they need to bust out
right.
Gonzo.
Gonzo and Rizzo are held in this lab by, of course, America's favorite actor, Jeffrey right. Tambor.
Right.
And also his henchman, Bobo.
And there's this whole, like, kind of great escapey kind of component to it, which is, like, trying to bust yeah. out. There's, like, a Shawshank Redemption kind of illusion at one right. point when Rizzo reels behind a poster that he's, like, dug a way out or whatever. Like, the rat stuff just doesn't totally work, but... I don't
but
know.
It's
kind of funny.
Scale, I'll say it works better than the other shit. Like, you know, like, yes, is yes, it great? Yes. Is it my favorite Muppet stuff? No, but when you watch this film, you have to go, like, comparatively, Rizzo and Pepe pop more than most of the classic Muppets. Even if you're, like, too much of this, anytime they cut back to, like, there's that moment where they cut back to all the Muppets in the Electric Mayhem bus, and they're like, we're going to save Gonzo. And just, you're like, none of these characters have any life in them anymore. Yeah. They have nothing to do in this movie. They're just in a bus saying, don't worry, eventually we'll get there and resolve the plot of this movie. But then it just becomes like they're sneaking in all the stuff they got from Dr.
Which ultimately they do.
Right. But it's like a lot of...
Yeah, I mean, ultimately we get to sort of this like... Yeah, it doesn't... Once we get to this like rave party waiting for the aliens bit... Which, I don't know, sort of reminded me of, like, a Burning Man thing.
Right. It's like the idea is because he did that news broadcast, then everyone else believes that aliens are real yeah. and they want to be there to see the aliens.
Okay. That's, yeah, I guess,
that
what
like,
we're supposed to believe.
An Independence Day, you know, right. when the L.A. Yep. one that was in a nondescript building. I still don't know what building they blew up. When
but
all the people
said,
are on the top waiting for them.
As Phil said, yeah, like, yeah, that yeah. is very much like this, like, hippie, like, peace and love flower child thing. And in this, it's yeah. very much like, you're right, it feels like a PG, like, Bonnaroo. Like, it feels like,
yeah.
right.
Like it sort of feels like in, yeah, it sort of feels like in Contact, yeah. when all those people show up thinking that the aliens are going to, and there's like a party out
right.
in the desert
but
sort of situation.
Again, I understand, like, if this is a remnant of a draft where the movie was more pointedly parodying different modern sci-fi movies. And Joey Mazzorano said in, like, Contact was one of the things he was riffing on in his script. It was Contact. It was Men in Black. It was Independence Day.
Right.
You see the pieces of that. There's the scene yeah. where Commissioner Gordon, the original Commissioner Gordon, Pat Hingle, comes
yes,
back in on Jeffrey Tambor, and he's trying to show proof that he has an alien because everyone's laughed at him his entire life, and his storyline is that he needs to prove that aliens are real so he no longer feels like a loser. But... They do the direct parody of the Independence Day scene, which in this movie, as it currently stands, sticks out very weirdly because the rest yeah. of the movie is not doing direct parody, and their only parody that still exists is of the most harrowing scene in a different movie.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's, it really
that
is just.
And then the end was so yeah. close encounters, but I feel like.
Yes.
That's, I yeah. feel like they do that in almost every movie where aliens come
everything.
Down now.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. yeah. So this movie sucks, but we'd like to talk about our things that we do like. And Griffin, I mentioned that we would do our top five Muppets.
Well, I want to ask Griffin one question before Phil, and I think you know where
okay,
I'm
please.
Going.
Yeah,
yeah. And then I want to give 5 seconds to the ending. But what's your question?
Yeah, please.
I want to know. Well, I don't actually usually ask questions straight up. I give you my opinion first. So my opinion is, mm-hmm. Gonzo is a problematic character.
Oh,
and
God.
I can't get over the fact that he has a harem of essentially mute chicken girlfriends.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Talk to me about that.
Look, it's hard to talk about. I think this is, I'm glad you brought this up because, I mean, this gets to a bigger point. There is a domestication of Gonzo that has made his character less and less functional over time. Gonzo used to be so deeply, thoroughly weird. I mean,
yeah.
the bit was, he he'd be backstage and he'd be going, "It's great, I'm going to do this." And it would just make zero sense. And then he would eat a tire while sliding down like a flaming hope, so you know, right. with a zip line with his nose. And then the chicken stuff. And the thing was just like, this guy is on another fucking wavelength. And that worked. And over time, they have made Gonzo more and more into just your wacky uncle, which I think is where the character really starts to fail. Because he just becomes a guy who wears loud ties, you know? Like, he stopped being a performer in the same sense. The Daredevil angle to him. I mean, there was this thing where he was like part Evel Knievel, but also part Frank Zappa. And yeah, that's where right. he really worked, where you're like, it's this weird like performance art thing. There's this weird level of like physical suffering to all his acts, but also he thinks himself as being a very highbrow artist. He's going to set all of his acts to classical music and things like that. And so then the chickens work as part of that because it's just like everything about this guy is just like a 10 on the crazy scale. Like everything's shooting in a different direction. When you make him a guy who wears like a black and white checkered suit and a tie that has chili peppers on it, you know, and a little like... becomes by the 90s, then it's just like, this guy just sucks. Like, this is like the middle manager at the office you hate. This is the uncle you get to sit next to, you know, at like Rosh Hashanah. Like, this guy blows. And then the chicken stuff, once he starts acting a little bit more like a normal human being, but just a little goofy, then the chicken stuff becomes upsetting to me. Because right. then he's actually at a different mental level than the chickens. Whereas in the earlier stages of the character, it felt like, well, this guy makes more sense with a chicken than he does with anything else, you know?
Yeah.
Now he's a little too high.
Exactly right.
Right. And so,
I agree.
It's the same thing with this. And it's why I think there's a kernel of a good idea in the premise that the opening gets to of just like, get back to hashtag keep Gonzo weird. Make Gonzo weird again, you know? Which this thing very quickly like veers off from. There are a couple moments, like individual, like short moments where this isn't even, I think it's just an end result of what is meant to be a visual gag. But when he's in that trance, like post zapping and he's on the lawnmower and his eyes are totally bugged out, his pupils are tiny. It's supposed to be oh, he's having some sort of like seizure or something. But I'm like, this feels like chaotic good in the way that Gonzo should. And then the rest of it, it's a lot of him making like shitty jokes to Jeffrey Tambor, you know, like in a way that doesn't fucking matter. And you also go like, does he need to be like fucking apprehended? Does he need to be tested? Can this movie not be, if this is the premise you want, and if the end point is he's going to stay with the Muppets because they shouldn't be his family, right? And I'll get to this in a second, but they shouldn't be his family and he should stay on Earth. Would it not make more sense that this movie is, and this is very classic Muppet movie, act one, you know, first 10, 15 minutes, what we've talked about, when he gets the zap, when he goes up to space, they tell him, Gonzo, you need to meet us here in 2 days. And they go, there? That's blank, blank miles away. How can we ever get there? And then he goes back to Earth, and the movie is the Muppets, with Gonzo included, in the bus, on the road trip, trying to get to the place. Yeah. So that the movie remains about Gonzo's relationship to these other Muppets, which is what they're trying to make it about. Because at the end, whether it was the intended script where it turns out that he's not an alien, or the current script where it turns out that he is an alien, but he decides to stay at home with the Muppets, this movie has to reassert why he cares more about the Muppets. And it fails to do that because he's separate for most of the running time. They save him. They go through the trouble of saving him, but he barely communicates with most of the characters for most of this movie. It doesn't feel like he has a strong emotional connection to most of them. And the big ones, as we said, like Fozzie, Kermit, Miss Piggy, are kind of like just sort of side fluff in this movie. Same with Animal. Like, it's really just him and Rizzo. And I do think it's like, I like the idea of this movie winding up to a point that is, there is no answer. Like, Gonzo has to accept that who he is a whatever. He doesn't need an explanation. Yeah. He's known who he is. He's been a Muppet for fucking 30 years. He starred in a bunch of movies. He's been on all these TV shows. He knows his role. Like, that's the lesson he should be learning. And instead, it's this thing of, like, they fucking land in the ship. which is maybe the only visual I really like in the movie. I think the actual model of the ship is good. There's a good 1999
yeah, the
cool. of miniatures
yeah.
kind of extended yeah. of the ship. Yeah.
Sure.
And the ship
sure.
opens up and there's shitty fucking like Muppet Funkadelic. And yep. they do, yep. God, what song did they do?
Oh, what's the song?
Is it Celebrate?
Yes. Yeah. I think so. Yes,
very upsetting.
Yeah. I know. And it sucks. They say, Gonzo, we have searched long and far for you. And now we have but one thing to say. Do the song. And at the end of the song, they go, so you coming home with us? And he's like, no, I'm going to stay with the Muppets. And it's like, wait a second. They're his fam. Is that guy his dad? Are they his or are they specifically his nuclear family? Like, who is he coming face to face with here? He hasn't had a conversation with them. They just sang a yeah. song on a beach and a bunch of fucking Woodstock 99 rejects swung around yeah. glow stick and then they said, so you're boarding or not? Like, that's the whole yep. fucking interaction. It is so emotionally shallow. And then when he turns back and goes, actually, I should stay with the Muppets, that also is shallow. Like, both sides of it are shallow. You don't understand why he would go with the aliens. You don't understand why he would stay at home with the Muppets. You don't understand why either of those things happen that quickly. And then the tie-up is, oh, no, Jeffrey Tambor, he's the one who belongs with them. He's yeah. the one. The arc of the movie is Jeffrey Tambor. The real complete narrative, emotional arc of this movie is Jeffrey Tambor finally finding where he belongs. And then it just cuts to them on a roof, and there's some blackout yep. gag, and the movie is over. And then what? There's a cover of Shining Star, and the Muppets are all kaleidoscopes. What the fuck is this
Correct.
Movie?
Correct.
Okay, top
it's
five
the worst.
Muppets.
Top five Muppets.
Top five Muppets. Top five Muppets. I'll start
really
with my number
five
Muppets. Dr. Bunsen Honeydew.
Top five Muppets.
Yes.
Okay.
Top five Muppets. Right,
Number five, you're saying.
My number five is Dr. Bunsen Honeydew. My question to you is, who came first, Honeydew or John Hodgman? Because they're basically the same, right? Like they're
absolutely.
They sound the same. They look the
Hodgman
same.
Hodgman has eyes.
Hodgman does have eyes.
On season two of The Tick, John Hodgman yes. plays a character yes. named Agent Hobbs. I'm trying to remember his full name, but the joke is that at one point we imply that Agent is his first name. I think, but
it's just I couldn't believe how much he sounded and looked like John Hodgman though.
Oh,
just
kind sure, of but in The Tick, consciously a Honeydew reference. Like when he met perfect. With Ben about the role, he said, "I essentially want you to play Dr. Honeydew." And Hodgman to that end insisted yeah. on in almost every scene having a clipboard because it comes with the Muppet physicality of usually one of Dr. Honeydew's hands was pressed against his chest with the clipboard so that they only right. had to puppeteer the other hand. So he moved
That's
like
fantastic.
That. Yes, John Hodgman, I think, you know, it's I don't want to say that John Hodgman's parents ripped off Bunsen Honeydew when they came to but at the very least there's some parallel going on there.
What is your number five?
I want to say mine is Dr. Bunsen Honeydew as well. And I feel like he is an underrated Muppet. I fight for him a lot. I think I can't put him higher than five. But I think Beaker is so beloved. And Honeydew is the consummate straight man. He also just yeah. is one of my favorite Muppet designs. I love the look of Honeydew. I love the voice of Honeydew. I love him on an aesthetic level. But like the man is he's selfless. He's Scottie Pippen, you know, to Beaker's Jordan. Like he let Beaker
That's
get
amazing.
The buckets, and yeah. he's probably grossly yeah. underpaid and locked into like. but Honeydew rules.
Yeah,
Kenny,
I'll give you my five. I made this right now, but
great.
There are a lot of Muppets. I must say. And as I said, I love the Muppets and I love watching them do what they do. There are a lot of Muppets that I don't have a lot of affinity for.
Sure. Well, there are a lot of them.
I don't like oversized Muppets very much. They scare the shit
wow.
out of me.
Wow.
Interesting.
Bobo's about as big as you like to get.
Well, the Sesame Street characters notwithstanding. I love them on Sesame Street.
Yes.
Sure. But I'm sorry. Within sure. Muppets universe proper, you would say that Bobo being...
Bobo being smaller than a human man,
right?
but not if, Jack size.
If you go above human size, you dislike. You're counting out your Sweetums, your Thogs.
Yeah, Sweetums for sure is
It'll take a lot. You're okay. already at a disadvantage. That said, I love Snuffleupagus. Okay. Absolutely love Snuffleupagus. Sure. So you can't. You know, you
and Big Bird, obviously. You love Big Bird.
So you like the Big Bird. Sesame Street Muppets.
But I really hate Sid and Marty Krofft characters.
Oh, interesting.
They make me physically ill.
And you said you just like Fraggle Rock, and Fraggle Rock has a lot of that size stuff.
I'm okay with Fraggle Rock the show.
Uh-huh.
But the because I don't mind it, that being the aesthetic of the world, but the fraggly characters within this world, I guess I'm a bit sizist when it comes to the Muppets.
No, but I guess the fraggles are small. The characters I would assume you would hate are, I'm forgetting their names now, the Gorgs, the big giants.
Yeah, like the Morlocks. The
Fraggles, yeah.
Right.
They're not the real Morlocks, you know what I mean? So,
What's your number
all
five?
Of mine fall within the classic Muppet size.
Sure, yes, correct.
I love Rolf. I love his sincerity.
Rolf's your number five.
Rolf.
And Rolf's, I love his. Rolf he's the first proper Muppet. He was Jim Henson's first breakout character, even before.
Oh, really?
And
I love his sincerity. I love he's got a dignity to him. Genuinely talented. Genuinely talented dog. So I really
can
like.
Can I make
Rolf.
A recommendation? There's an album that Jim Henson recorded in like the 80s and then never released, and it was only released maybe 5 years after he died, called "Old Brown Ears Is Back." And it's That's Rolf weird. Singing standards. It's like a Rolf Sinatra album. It's a studio album of mm-hmm. Rolf doing some songs he had sung before, some songs that were popular by other Muppets, and some standards. It's a great album. It's a great
album.
He's got a great voice.
He's very distinct. He's not like the other Muppets. I really like that. And I think you'll notice as I go along. I like the distinctness.
The classics.
Of course, I love the classics, but the distinctness that isn't, that isn't defined by size in a peppy kind of way.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. You're not a sizes. Phil, your number four.
Yeah, my number four is Beaker. Wow. He's great.
Jordan.
I love him. He's Jordan. I don't know. Who doesn't love to see him get electrocuted all the time and screaming? He's great.
He never misses.
Yeah.
I am a little disappointed because when you put Bunsen at five, I went, finally, I have an ally in thinking that Bunsen is better than Beaker. But of course, you were putting Bunsen at five only.
I'm sorry. What's your number four?
My number four is Janice. Janice is my favorite of the Electric Mayhem.
People love Janice.
Most people go for, obviously, Animal. But Janice for me is as you said, so specific. She is such a specific, because the idea is that Animal is kind of Keith Moon. Is sort of half Pink Floyd, half the Beatles amalgam. Dr. Teeth is Dr. John. Right. Zoot is supposed to be Miles Davis, maybe, I think. Then Janice is obviously supposed to be a sort of Janis Joplin, Mamas and the Papas type character. But I think
real
he's
Joni
such
Mitchell
a
look.
Joni Mitchell, right. I mean, she's all that sort of era of like 60s, 70s female rock. I think she is sort of underrated in her hit ratio because she so often isn't center stage. But almost every time Janice has a line, it's a big hit. And I think she's got a great voice. I think she's a great musician. I think she is underrated in terms of versatility, both between the bass guitar and also the tambourine. I think she's a great character. And also, I just think they're only two prominent female Muppets.
I know.
It's an issue, but
that's
in the
crazy.
Classic group, it really is Janice and Piggy are the only two who are in the regular rotation. And Piggy gets a lot of credit, so I always try to boost Janice whenever I can.
Kenny, what's your number four?
Man, this is going to go over like a... like Led Zeppelin. Piggy is my number four.
Yeah. Hey, no, I like Piggy. Okay. I'm just saying I'm the less represented Muppet.
Miss Piggy's great.
For someone who is always kind of playing in this narrow kind of range, she's so versatile.
Yes.
Like there's just something about her where she just you can put her Now, this might be part of the Muppets' problem of only having two female characters and really only having one who's part of the ensemble, right?
Right.
Janice is chilling out in the band with, you know, yes, Kevin Eubanks.
She's got a good vibe. Janice just has a good vibe.
Yeah, yeah. Janice is great. But Piggy can do so much. And Piggy needs to do so much, but she can do so much. She pulls it all off.
Talk about range. Piggy does it all. Yeah,
she does it all.
My number three is Fozzie. I think that, and I mentioned this to Kenny, we were texting about this. Fozzie to me really encapsulates, and I'm not a comedian. Mm. I haven't tried any comedy or done stand up, but he personifies everything that I think a comedian is. His insecurity, his just like his desire, his need to make people laugh. So that's, I think Fozzie's the best.
Very interesting take as a comedian. I wonder where Fozzie is going to come in on my ranking.
What's your number three?
My number three is Scooter. Scooter's, I think, great. Is very easily. As you notice here, I'm putting in a lot of Muppets who I think don't get the credit they deserve. Okay? My top two are going to be more obvious picks. But I like to boost some of the Muppets who I think are doing a lot of the really heavy, invisible lifting. And Scooter is, we talk about like the Walter problem. Scooter is successful Walter. Scooter is creating a bridge between the Muppets and sort of us.
Yeah.
Right. Scooter was, a vaguely humanoid Muppet, but they also say that he's a gopher, but the joke is that he's more of a gopher, like a PA gopher.
Yeah.
His uncle owns the Muppet Theater, and so he starts working backstage, and he's got all the grunt work, knocking on the doors, telling the people who's up next. But there's a little micro arc for a show that is not serialized. There's a little micro arc throughout the five seasons, The Muppet Show, of Scooter starting to build up the courage to perform. That he starts out as sort of behind the scenes guy plucked.
It's true.
His job only because of nepotism. He only gets the job because of nepotism. But then he really proves that he's one of them. And they originally think, like, this guy's a fucking cop. This guy's a square. Like, he doesn't belong to that. And Scooter really proves his own. And I think the first time Scooter does a performance on The Muppet Show, Kermit introduces him. He goes like, would you believe it? I mean, this is weird. Our own gopher, he wants to do a song. And it's very endearing to me that by the end of the run, he's performing more regularly. In the first couple of movies, when Richard Hunt's still alive, he's a real part of the team. He's the Electric Mayhem's manager. He's part of the group in college. All this stuff. Works at the Happiness Hotel. I think he's a great character. And he's an everyman. He's not flashy. You know, he doesn't have a big character game. He doesn't have a big skill set. But he's just a good guy.
I like Scooter, too.
He's a great guy. I think Scooter's great.
It's a great sales job.
He was boring as a kid, but I grow to appreciate Scooter more and more with each passing year. Now
you know who he is?
Kenny, what's your number three?
You know who he is in a weird way? All right, two things. You just convinced me that Scooter would be a more interesting character to do a movie about than Gonzo.
Scooter's a great character to do a movie about.
Correct.
And this movie is the first time Scooter speaks after Richard Hunt dies, which is about 10 years later, and I think he has one line.
I think I read it was his brother who took over. Mm-hmm. But second is, can I remember it? No, I'm sure it wasn't that interesting.
Okay.
But
what's your number three, Kenny?
This is going to haunt me forever. It was Scooter related. The number three is my favorite designed character. And my love of my life, the Swedish Chef. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Those human hands. Oh, God, the balls of these people.
I mean,
to put human hands on this character and make the hand. First of all, his design is amazing.
Incredible.
His face is amazing.
Yeah.
Everything about him is amazing. And then to say, we're going to make these human hands the focus of this character. I could watch that motherfucker cook all day.
I don't know. I usually have it here on my desk, a Swedish Chef action figure, but instead I have all the pieces that come with them. I have a chicken here and a pot.
The Swedish Chef is the best.
If the Swedish Chef was my first favorite Muppets character, the Swedish Chef is who my family did bits about when we were growing up. We did the Swedish Chef voice.
Sure.
He has a real place in my heart. And if it weren't for, the brilliance of kind of the core two.
Yeah.
And I'll say this. I know I was saying that Phil von Neuter was trying to replace Muppet Labs. He was also trying to replace Swedish Chef. Because I don't know if you noticed, Phil Von Neuter is a similar puppet where it's like fingers.
Got some human hands.
Right. Mm-hmm. He's wearing felt over the hands because he needs to be green or yellow or whatever he is. But
I didn't notice
that.
But it upsets me.
Puppet movement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So my number two is actually my favorite, I think, aesthetic design puppet. Animal's my number two. Or is what I can only assume is what a young Ben Hosley was like. Was Animal.
I think pretty close. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
Feels like that. It's pretty close. I love the simplicity of Animal. He's just, I love the id that he is.
Yes.
That he's just like, he's just rampant chaos. I also loved like the Tasmanian Devil when I was a kid too. Like, I just love sort of an agent of
chaos.
That's
what my brother was. My brother was like a very physically active, antsy kid, and he was always drawn to Animal, Tasmanian Devil, whoever that agent of chaos character was.
Yeah, it's just great. And I also, I mean, I mentioned Ben because when I watched the Muppet movie again for the first time and Animal gets big in the Muppet movie, I was just like, this must have just been Ben's favorite, Ben Hosley's favorite thing ever. It's just Animal getting big.
I have a lot of respect for Animal. Love him. I think Animal's very true to himself.
He is. And I love just the style of like his hair. I think he's the best. But
I'm trying to get what's your quote here. I'm sorry. I might be paraphrasing this. But Frank Oz says that Animal is pure id with everything removed other than the desire for sleep, food, and sex. He says drum, sleep, food, sex, and pain.
Look at that. Because he's right over Griffin. We're on the Zoom, and Griffin shows the Muppets from Space as a background. So
he is right over his shoulder.
Animal is prominent right over his shoulder. Yeah. Look at that gorgeous character design.
I know.
He has never run a comb through his hair once.
It's beautiful.
It's so good. Can I say another thing that I hate about this movie? They got Animal wearing like some fucking Billabong t-shirt the entire time.
Yeah,
it's awful. He cares. Like he fucking would. Like he would ever wear a label.
That's true too.
Nope, not what he would wear. Not what he would wear. He would tear this thing to pieces.
No. What's your number two, Griffin?
My number two is Gonzo. Now, there's a slight asterisk here, which is it's sort of the best version of Gonzo is my number two. Gonzo at his purest.
Okay.
I think essentially Gonzo gets less and less pure as time goes on. The first season of The Muppet Show is my favorite Gonzo. And it is when Gonzo is incredibly sad and the puppet looks sad and the performance is sad. And David Goles has said that he watched it and he felt like it was too depressing. He didn't find the character until a couple years later. I think he nailed it the first time out. I think Gonzo remains good after that, but he has, as I was saying, gotten more and more domesticated as time has gone on. In theory, I should be right in the wheelhouse for this movie. I'm ready for a sort of Gonzo as emotional center story. But it's the wrong film, it's the wrong take, and they've lost their handle on the character. But I do love that he is just a pure, unbridled creativity, love of performance. You know, he's like a true artist who does not even think about how the audience is going to receive what he's doing. He just follows his own whims, and it's pure bliss for him. And I do love the whateverness of him. It's one of the reasons I don't like this movie trying to solve it, is that I like sort of, it's not even a metaphor, but the idea of just like, he is the type of person who just feels disconnected from all of humanity, you know?
Sure.
It is yeah, not like, you know, he doesn't have body dysmorphia, he doesn't have gender dysphoria, he is just like, he just doesn't feel like anyone else. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like a good angle to have in the Muppet universe because of how they relate to everything else around them.
I agree with that. What do you got for number two, Kenny?
This movie up so badly. You could have done a great job, Griffin. One day you're going to get this franchise.
This gig?
Number two, Fozzie Bear. We already talked about him. But
he's great. Yeah.
He's the best. I want to say one thing about Gonzo, which is I remember as a child being scared of Gonzo.
Really?
Yeah. That's part of what I like about Gonzo.
And that's what I'm getting at. No, that's what I'm getting at, too. A character that can scare a child like that, but who isn't necessarily intended to scare children.
No. Yeah.
There's something really kind of magical about that. That's
it means
a visceral emotion.
Right. That visceral emotion is the result of them tapping into something. There are all these primal things that original Gonzo,
right.
These nerves that he's touching.
Right. And, you know, Animal doesn't scare me or anything like that, or any, you know, but there is something about Gonzo's. It's not even the whateverness. It's the, when you were talking about Gonzo and the chickens, it's the wild cardness of him.
It's the wild card, right? The wavelength thing of just like,
the unpredictability.
Who knows what this motherfucker's going to do?
Right. He's right.
Have you ever
so
had a friend? You ever had a friend like that?
Yes.
I have a friend like that. He's not really me. I have a guy I grew up with.
Sure.
And who would do crazy things, right?
Yeah.
Truly, truly crazy things. Yeah. Some are very bad, and I should not tell them on the air.
A microphone?
And some are very bad. And then some are, you know, are pretty, you know, tame. Like he once just went up to the counter at McDonald's and ordered, you know, 2 heart attacks, a coronary, and a death before I'm 30. Mm-hmm. So he's no fear like that. Sometimes the crazy things do things like he came to my engagement party and he was a perfect gentleman. And I got his card at the end, and inside the card, he gave me a gift. The gift was $20. It was a 10, a 5, and 5 ones. That to me was so crazy. Like, where did you? Like, it's lovely, it's sweet, you clearly put thought into this, but like, how did you come up with those denominations?
But you're getting at a Gonzo thing too, which is like, I want to underline, he is chaotic good, you know?
Right, that's what I'm saying about my friend, yeah.
Destructive, you know? Gonzo is very supportive, he is very genuine, he tries to be transparent. Like, one of the things I love about Gonzo is he's always trying to explain what he's doing or what he's thinking as if it's natural. It just doesn't make sense to us. There's nothing devious about him. There's nothing withholding about him.
And this friend was also a bit of a, he wasn't a performer, as in he was a guy on stage, but he was a guy who was a little odd. And he desperately wanted everybody to love him and think he's funny. And sometimes it manifested itself in really kind of dangerous ways. And sometimes in really kind of funny ways. And sometimes in really sweet ways. So I feel Gonzo. Fozzie reminds me kind of my dad. And he's not my dad. He's nothing like my dad. But there is this kind of like, you just want to like kind of give him a hug. And he just, he wants your approval. And you know what? He's working so hard for it. He deserves it. And there's something very, very reassuring and comforting about Fozzie Bear.
I agree with that. My number one is kind of, I mean, I hate to say it, but it feels obvious, but it is Kermit. And for me, so I mentioned this to Kenny. When I was a kid, I had a Kermit doll, I guess. He was probably about this big. I don't know. He wasn't that, but he was like felt. He was a stuffed animal, basically, version of him. And when I was younger, I would sleep with Kermit. And like Kermit just has this, I have such a like calmness. When I look at Kermit, he just makes me feel better about the world. He just seems like a guy he's doing his best, and he's gonna do the best he can to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
And I you can't ask for anything.
That's a great take. My number one is the Muppet I had a doll of that I would sleep with under my arm. And it's also, as you said, I think it is still to this day maybe the best depiction in any scripted media of how the comedian mind works and what makes them tick. And I would say Fozzie is single-handedly the reason I went into comedy. Like, Fozzie was an activator in comedy. I understood how jokes were told by watching The Muppet Show, where you hear him try to write bits, and then you see him perform them on stage, and then you see them go wrong, which makes you think about the construction of jokes and what is or isn't being communicated and how he fucked up the performance. And then you add on the jokes on top of that, Statler and Waldorf, like, bagging on him. Fozzie's like my North Star. He's like everything. Yeah, I think he's the best.
He's fantastic.
Kenny,
what's
mine
your
is
one?
Kermit as well. And there's just
he's great. He's great.
I am very drawn to home run swings. Home run swings, and I think you know this for over the course of the podcast, but whether or not they go over the fence or they're just a wild strike, I love the idea of a home run swing, and I consider Kermit to be a home run swing, because to put such a reserved, observational and observant Slyly funny, slyly sarcastic character, but totally competent at the center, and has that coach quality to him.
But also, at his best, is always on the verge of a mental breakdown.
As is, you know, I mean, I think the I think the idea at the end of the day is right. He is a director,
right? Yes,
he is a director, and the best directors are able to somehow push off that mental breakdown,
yes,
which is inevitable when you're juggling what you have to juggle.
Everyone on their own level, and somehow just keep the chaos at bay, barely.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that is such a bold home run swing to me. The, like, as wonderful and incredible as Bugs Bunny is, and he's incredible, a little fucking obvious, right? Just a little bit. And they nailed it. And don't get me wrong, they nailed it. Bugs Bunny is the platonic ideal of the center of this kind of comedy troupe. More power to it.
But he's not a leader. Kermit's a leader.
To put an understated character in that, you know who he reminds me of in a weird way? Or I guess who reminds me of him is Jon Stewart on The Daily Show.
Yeah.
Like that you have all these crazy, wacky characters around him playing characters. They're all kind of doing bits and playing characters. And he is holding this whole thing together and being incredibly funny while doing it, but while always giving the shine to the other people.
I think it's one of the reasons Kermit has not been able to connect after Henson died. And I generally like what Whitmire did with him for most of the run. And I like Matt Vogel, who's playing Kermit now. But the problem is that Kermit really was Henson's alter ego. And everything you're saying is those are the roles that Henson played in relation to everyone else who worked on the Muppets. Like that character, the reason why a character who in so many ways is kind of passive, is kind of neutral, is competent, you know, isn't wacky, was that engaging was because it was so honest. It wasn't manufactured. Yeah. It was like Kermit was him speaking honestly to the audience. And for a guy who was famously somewhat reserved, even with his family, was not very open with his emotions, it felt like Kermit was the one time he was like fully letting loose everything he felt.
You know, it would probably be an uncomfortable thing for another puppeteer, another actor, to step into that role.
Yeah.
And try to embody it in the way you would need to embody that character to make it
work. Also, whoever's playing that role is not offstage embodying that role in the same way that Henson was. It was working on two levels. Like, the other characters were to Kermit what the other performers were to Jim Henson, and vice versa. And that's not going to be replicated again.
No, and what happens because of what you're saying is he just turns into a boring, aimless,
kind of bland guy. Yeah.
Bland character. And I think that's why, you know, the choice of Kermit as your favorite Muppet seems like you don't really love the Muppets. But I don't think you would think this at all, Griffin, but just in general, I think it's that's the character I want. Kermit's the one who gets me. Kermit's the one who gets me excited in the I don't really care much about the two adaptations, but before that, those first three movies and the shows, that's what I want.
And Kermit's not a big part of either of those movies. I mean, I think they, to their credit, knew after Henson died, we cannot put him at the center without that guy performing him. The character just doesn't connect in the same way.
Mm-hmm. So, are you cool to rate this movie, Griffin? I don't know if you remember our rating system, but I'll walk you through it real quick. But basically, Kenny and I didn't see this movie in 99, so you can give us your rating of it in 99, and then we'll give our ratings of it before the podcast and after the podcast, because speaking for myself, this podcast definitely changed my rating of this movie. So do you want to give your rating and say what you thought it was in 99?
I'm trying
to, out of 0 to 99, that is?
From 0 to 99. I think in the year 1999, I probably would have given this movie like a 70 or a 72. I think I went into it debating whether or not I still want to see a Muppet movie. I laughed throughout most of it. I felt like this feels like it's still borderline cool for me to like, but it soured pretty quickly in my mind without even having to rewatch it. I think now I give this movie probably about on a scale of 99. I think I would give it like a 21. And most of those points are for like individual micro moments or just the movie having Muppets in it automatically is 10 points, you know? Yeah. That's an automatic 10 for me. So it's almost like they're getting a lot of those points just for writing their name on the SAT test. But I think it's a 20s movie for me. Maybe if it's a little higher, it's 25, 26, but it's in that range.
Yeah.
Let me go next, Phil.
I would say
the next because I haven't changed much, and I'm interested to hear how much you've changed and in what direction. I had it at a 24, which is, you know, a crushing disappointment, but I expected it to be bad. Like, I think everyone everyone knows that this is not.
It doesn't have a good reputation.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. And I do think it was worse than I thought it would be. There's almost no charm. And so many, like,
truly dreading the rewatch. It was worse than I remembered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then I do wonder how much Jeffrey Tambor's recent behavior colors my opinion of him watching it.
But in 1999, I thought he was scoring in this movie. I said, this is a breakout performance. You know, I, of course, had not seen Larry Sanders' show before, so I said, "You won't believe this guy they discovered." I got this one box here, and every line's a laugh. But yeah, watching this today, I found this performance very dull and humorless. And current opinions of him aside, I rewatched all of Larry Sanders this year, and personal life be damned, that's still a good performance. This is not a very engaging performance.
That and Arrested Development. I mean, and Transparent. I mean, like you can't say he's not a talented guy, but there's something about his on-screen presence after, you know, what's come out about him has come out that really does kind of turn your stomach a little bit. So,
but the bully elements come to the forefront. Yes,
particularly with this role, right? I don't know. There's something about Tambor that if you don't want to like him, he's pretty easy not to like.
Agreed.
So I was 24. I got a little angrier at this movie than I expected. And when I get angry,
you're giving it Jack Bauer. Yeah.
I'm gonna go down to an 18. I don't want this to be super low on my rankings. I've gone lower, but it is as bad of a movie as we've done outside of the, you know, the straight up incompetence.
And I'll say this too. It's a movie that irritates me. Like, it's a movie where it's several moments I go, ugh. You know, which it's like, there are bad movies that I can watch and intellectually go, this is not good. But I don't feel the same level of frustration while watching them. This is a movie that, like, is unpleasant for me to rewatch, largely.
That's right. Yeah, it was an unpleasant experience. And I watched it with two of my kids, both of whom despised it. And they're, you know,
you're throwing tomatoes at the screen. You're doing
real fast on the Muppets. The
yeah, you got it. This is pretty funny. Yeah.
So, Griffin,
you could hear them shitting on the Muppets right now.
It's my 3-year-old who is not yet into the Muppets. Who's he telling
the
me?
The plot is rudderless.
He's been in this room with me this whole time, being very calm on the phone. But now he needs help. So I have 4 kids. I don't know if you know that podcast. two of them. Yeah, that's right. Two of them are 8. 8-year-old twins, and one of them's walking in the room right now. Maybe she should give us her take. But what happened with my children and the Muppets was I was desperately trying to get them into the Muppets, specifically because the Muppets exhibit was opening up at the Skirball.
Yes.
And I desperately wanted to go to that. And I cannot get 2 to 3 hours out of my day to do something for myself, but I could easily get 2 to 3 hours of my day to take the kids there. I'm not going to take the kids there unless they go kicking and screaming. I'm not going to take the kids there kicking and screaming. I'd rather have them go and get excited. So we watched the first 3 Muppet movies, and I think they liked it. Layla, would you say you liked the first 3 Muppet movies? Lukewarm. She's giving me a lukewarm look. But enough to get them to stand in a 2-hour line with me at the Skirball to go see the Muppet exhibit, which they fucking hated. Sorry, she's in the room. They hated it so much that it soured them on the Muppets for 2 years.
Do they like museums? Is it just
they love museums? What was it about the Muppet? What was it here? Go ahead, Layla. What was it about the Muppet Museum that you didn't like?
It was like for babies. It like
whoa.
It didn't really. It wasn't like a museum. It was weird.
It was weird.
Right? Yeah. It, like, didn't have anything, like, that was cool. It just had, like, pictures. Not anything. Not, was it?
Fun. I liked it because I'm like a baby, which Layla knows.
I feel direct body blow to most of my interests.
I know. I could see as she was talking. You were, like, holding onto your gut. So... This yeah, one, unfortunately,
I'm not going to yell at your daughter, Kenny, but I'm. What was just
unfortunately, the next foray back into the Muppets was this movie, which did not go over that well.
No, absolutely not.
So I didn't hate this movie as much as you guys coming into this podcast. I gave it a 40. That's not good, obviously, but it's still not as bad as you guys. I'm down to a 29 having been through this podcast with you guys, because it just feels as though I gave it a little bit more credit than it probably deserved. There was some stuff in there that I liked a little bit more than others. And as you said, Griffin, it's the Muppets, and it's hard to hate a Muppet movie, like really hate it. But that's
what, and in my mind's eye, in my mind's eye, going in for this rewatch, not having seen it in probably close to 20 years, I was telling myself, I bet it's not as bad as I remember. I bet I'm going to give it somewhere in the 40s or 50s. You know, my idea was maybe it's quietly a gentleman's six. It's not up to the standard of the other one. But this is...
it's not a good movie. So I'll just two quick things before we let you go, Griffin. The first is you're going to come back and we're going to do another episode with you on... what I believe is the most Griffin thing we could possibly do, which is I guess you would say a supersized merchandise spotlight on the movie tie-in toys and perhaps even some
food. I want to talk some food tie-ins.
This is
and
so
some fast
exciting.
Food tie-ins.
Yeah.
I'm really excited for this. So you're going to come back and we're going to record that episode. But what we're going to air next week, I also want to hear your thoughts on, which is we're doing an episode with Dana Schwartz. We're doing Electric.
Great Dana Schwartz.
So that's
one of my favorite movies. The Great Dana
I that's sort of where I want to sort of ask your thoughts on Election, and also The Great is the Alexander Payne of it all too. Like, do you think he's a guy that you guys would ever do?
I've thought about it, and I will say I don't know why. But like week one of quarantine, I just dove headfirst into doing a little personal pain marathon. I don't know what spurred it even, but I watched most of them over the course of a couple days. I really like him. I find him really interesting. I feel like I am one of the preeminent downsizing defenders in North America.
You might be.
I really go to the mat for that movie.
Are you a real paniac?
I hadn't really processed how much of a paniac I think I am. There are a couple I've yet to revisit, but I saw Election about a year ago in a theater. It was playing here in New York City.
And that's cool.
I just think that's a perfect movie. And I think it's one of those movies that just inexplicably only ages better and better and better. Like, it's one of those films, like RoboCop for me, where somehow... every time you watch it, you go, well, now it's more relevant than ever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy watching it now, how relevant it is. And then you watch it five years later and you're like, I mean, I thought it was relevant 5 years ago. The answer is that our society keeps on getting worse and worse.
That's right. Yes. Well, I mean, after the 2016 election, the movie Election became just paramount, you know, just this.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a paramount picture.
Pun. Yes.
But I think it's a great movie. I think it's a perfect film. There'll be a burn burner for an episode.
So
I'm super
Election
excited.
is the highest movie I had that we'll be doing thus far. It was number 3 in my beginning of podcast list.
I think it's either my 2 or 3. It's probably my 2.
So what's
it's a near perfect movie. I can't wait to crack open my Criterion, which I own but have not watched specifically, waiting for us to do it. I mean, it's You know, I just rewatched actually the other day Pleasantville, which I really love and actually holds up incredibly well. And Reese Witherspoon in Pleasantville into Cruel Intentions into Election is just a it's a murderer's row. It's a great
Paul Thomas Anderson. Reese Witherspoon's the business.
She's the business. She's great. I can't wait to talk about it. But again, Griffin, thank you for talking with us about Muppets for I don't even know how long we've talked about Muppets at this point. More than 2 hours.
I checked the time. Well, thank you. It was a pleasure. I'll take any excuse I can to talk Muppets. And I look forward to doing the merchandise episode, which we were originally going to do back with this. But I appreciate having a little time to reset.
And also give the Muppets the time they deserve. And they deserve all the time.
Very serious episode, the merchandise.
yes, absolutely. Well, thank you again for being on here, Griffin. If you don't mind...
Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it. You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it. You want a podcast like it? 1999.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.